You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week, Erin Aubrey Kaplan. She is a Los Angeles-based journalist, has written columns for the LA Times, LA Weekly, Salon, Essence, Ms., and other publications. And she has a book out called I Heart Obama. Erin Aubrey Kaplan, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you on here. Very interesting book. Tell our listeners why you love Obama.
Well, I do love Obama, although it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek because I make this declaration that I embrace Obama. For various reasons, mostly because he's someone with whom I identify, not just as a politician, as a president, but as a person, as a sort of fellow Black American who's, you know, making his way. That's a whole other discussion I have. But it's, I guess you could call it a critical embrace. I mean, actually, because I feel connected to him, for the last 8 years, I have been very sort of warily following him, watching what he's doing, seeing how he evolves as president. And I have not been happy the whole way because I really have felt such a personal stake in the whole, you know, enterprise of him being president. But I do fundamentally, I guess, identification is the kind of love I'm talking about. It's the first time I felt in my lifetime, and I'm Obama's age, so we're the same generation, that I really felt this sense of something was at stake with an elected official. I mean, frankly, I grew up in the 70s and afterward, and, you know, I first voted at 18 in 1980, and Reagan got in office, and it kind of all felt downhill from there to me. But so Obama was this major development for all of us in the country, but particularly for me, because I felt that I just grown very cynical, I suppose, in electoral politics. And I really felt in the beginning Obama had this ideal, this one America ideal, which seems a long time ago now, but it really resonated. It really revived my tentative belief in that ideal, and it has not gone the way I'm sure he wanted it to go. But, you know, I did believe, and for a bit, and I was not at all sure he could affect this change, because that's really the big change he was hoping for. But I was very interested in watching him try to do it, and I was fearful of his chances of success, and I had reasons for that. But, you know, the main thing is that I felt connected to him. I felt invested in what he did, how he did it, in a way that I never felt invested before in an elected official, and certainly not in a president.
In the book, you cite your own views over time and those of other people you interview. You quote a number of you quote a number of other people on their views about Obama.
Sure.
And what you seem to have fallen in love with and others in your book includes his looks, his voice, his mm-hmm. poise, his facial expressions, and of course his skin color, his race. I mean, are these good reasons to support a politician or even to get married to somebody for that matter?
Well, it might be a good reason to get married to somebody. I don't know. Of course they're not good reasons, quote-unquote, to embrace a politician. I think that, but I really think that's the point. One of the points I'm trying to make, and one of the reasons I unabashedly say I heart Obama, he is, in addition to being a president, of course, he is this rock star, which is a phrase we use to describe somebody who is just magnetic, charismatic, kind of independent of what they actually do, whether they're a rock star or not. I was really taken by just his symbolism as this figure that I could just embrace and swoon over and be excited about for no other reason than the fact that, you know, I could. That is not, you know, why someone should vote for anyone. Although I will say, I think electoral politics is so much about emotion. That's just the reality, particularly a president, which was such a figurehead. And this idea that Obama could actually sort of charm so many Americans is actually very powerful to me. I mean, it's not just a frivolous idea that, oh, you know, he's attractive, he you know, people like the way he looks, the way he walks. that has a real power culturally. I mean, in a pop culture way. And I really appreciated that power. I had never seen that in a black figure before, and that was very interesting and kind of exciting to me. But that is, you know, a thing apart in a way from, of course, his politics and his policies. But I really think that's a huge part of politics anyway, and particularly presidential politics. And Obama used that, or I guess deployed that very well.
So let me tell you my impression as someone who does not heart Obama any more than I heart any other human being, and in fact is rather put off by his performance in the White House. It seems to me, reading through your account, that you and lots of other people whom you quote were looking for a real agent of progressive change, and you had mm-hmm. that hope for change, and you were disappointed, but you didn't want anybody expressing that disappointment. That would be sort of offensive. But at the same time, you sort of blame the failure of the public to rise up and apply pressure for Obama's failures to act. I mean, this seems like a rather twisted way of defending Obama at every turn. I mean, how could he possibly do any wrong under that approach?
Well, I don't think it wasn't a matter of him not doing any wrong. I think there are plenty of people who are, I quote in the book, who are progressives and actually just ordinary black people who were not at all happy with many things he did. I think what you're talking about is this unwillingness to criticize him in public, perhaps. And, you know, that's a really particular thing with a lot of black people. It really felt caught. There's so much going on. On the one hand, they were thrilled he became president. What, you know, huge symbolism. Two, there were expectations that, of course, the black man in office is going to, in some ways, address the generations-old racial crisis. You know, I mean, there are lots of crises in the country, certainly, that he inherited particularly, but there was this, you know, natural expectation he could do something about that. And at the same time, people said, well, his hands are going to be tied. He's, you know, the way politics work in this country, you don't directly address racial crises. It's no longer in fashion. Can't do that. The criticism of him was always out there, but there was as we watched the opposition, the real fierce opposition to him, which mostly was in Congress, but also, you know, certainly was centered in the Tea Party, we watched that develop and felt that, well, you know, why pile on the criticism? He's getting, you know, so much antipathy, and a lot of it racial antipathy. There was an unwillingness to voice our own criticism. So I'm just looking at all the pieces of this puzzle. I mean, I'm not saying any responses were absolutely correct, but I think it was just very complex and just wasn't, you know, black and white, so to speak. But it was just a real first for everybody, I think.
Well, let's just look at this distinction between criticizing a politician in public and somewhere else. I mean, what value would there be in criticizing a politician in private?
Well, see, that's the thing. I really believe that, of course, Obama's a politician, but he just was not seen that way amongst black people. He was a real figure. In fact, I call him, you know, he's this symbol. Of course, he's first black president. Therefore, he's like Jackie Robinson. He's like a Joe Lewis. He's like a that kind of figure, which is not just a politician. It's like a cultural figure. In fact, I call him a folk hero because in other ways he is like one of us, the sort of fellow black American who is trying to, you know, trying to make his way, trying to do his job, so to speak. And so we didn't quite, of course, he's president, he's a politician, that's certainly him, that's his public face, but I really believe a lot of black folks saw him in a very specific way as this modern, not a black leader, that's a whole other chapter, whether he's even a black leader, but a very key cultural and historical figure that we're constantly trying to assess. And the conversations we had about him were not just about his policies and what he's doing, but about him as a figure, as a sort of a member of our family. You know, what we looking at what he was doing as president, criticizing his policies or agreeing with them, and also kind of watching how he's being treated by Congress, by other Americans, by you know, the outside world. So all these, you know, he really is, you know, in a way, very kaleidoscopic. He represents so many things to black people, and, you know, there was always this conversation going on that it was not exactly public. It really was insular, and I really wanted to kind of examine that, and because to me it was a huge piece of, it will be, I think, a big piece of Obama's legacy that that literally did not get talked about, because we really have just been focused so much on the politics the last 8 years, and that's been the public discussion, and, you know, rightly so, because that has been evolving. But there, at the same time, I wanted to look at the more subtle and less talked about aspects of his presence in the White House.
Yeah, we're speaking with Erin Aubrey Caplan, whose book is I Heart Obama. It just seems to me that if you cheer for Jackie Robinson or if you boo for Jackie Robinson, thousands of people don't die as a consequence. You know, the president is actually in a position of great impact on the world.
Sure.
So that President Obama has just now said that overthrowing the government in Libya was a mistake. Well, some of us were screaming at the top of our lungs 5 years ago, don't do it. Mm-hmm. Now, we were inappropriate, we were out of place, we were racist, whatever we were, we then thought what he thinks now. So, you know, what are we supposed to think now, and what are we supposed to do about a so-called mistake that, of course, is actually a serious crime resulting in thousands of deaths and a country thrown into chaos and weapons dispersed around a region that is extremely violent. What, you know, are we supposed to sort of look away because Obama is this figure of mythical proportions, or are we supposed to treat him as a public servant and hold him accountable for what he does?
Well, I'm not suggesting you don't hold him accountable. And there are many things that I bring up in the book that troubled me on the foreign policy side. I mean, I'm not even sure, you know, killing Osama bin Laden was a great thing. There is, of course, the whole heightened security state that he oversaw. He could own that. There's all sorts of things. I'm not disagreeing with your view of Obama. I guess my point writing the book was to really look at Obama as a figure amongst African Americans, starting with myself. And no one I talked to suggested that people were racist for example, for criticizing Obama about what he did in Libya. Or in other places, or in the Middle East, or, you know, that is, you know, it's not that black and white at all. It's just that, you know, when I would actually ask people about these moves, you know, in Libya and in other places, they would say, yes, but, and they would widen the context and say, what about other presidents? What about the positive things he's done? There was, you know, what about his opening relations with Cuba? And they would go into other issues. And so there was this great fear that Obama would be, or the great anxiety that Obama would not be given his due. That was something that was very strong, this idea that Obama was going to be consigned to failure. And I am not saying he has not failed on many fronts, but that's just the anxiety that I felt out there amongst a lot of black folk, was Obama's not going to be given his due, he's not going to be put in proper context. And I know that can sound like an excuse, but in some people's minds, you know, I mean, maybe it was for some people, but most people were very concerned about this over-focus on all that Obama has done wrong and not what he has done right or you know, just it really had more to do with characterization of Obama. And, you know, that gets complicated because there is a very strong progressive critique, you know, of him, which I think is legitimate. But that just overall did not really sway a lot of black people from their attachment to, connection to Obama as a figure.
Yeah, although there's an argument that when people are in a biased manner criticizing him at every turn and going silent when he does something right, the way to counter that is to honestly praise what he does right and criticize what he does wrong, not become a biased voice of only praise, which doesn't sway anybody either. And people just begin to see bias everywhere and nobody being honest. I mean, it seems to me that obviously we live in a very racist society. If Obama's drone victims had been white, he would have been impeached within a year, I think.
Right.
But if Obama's drone victims had been picked out and killed every Tuesday by a Republican, the peace movement would have been in the streets screaming bloody hell, right?
And you know what? I do not disagree with you. I think as you were talking, it made me realize that, the answer is the solution is not to, not to praise him at every turn. But, he was so consistently almost insulted at every turn. I mean, everything he did within, the Republican Congress, he just, nothing could happen with them. And so this very public rejection of him by Congress and by what I call the white right, which is, kind of basically the Tea Party faction, so I think infuriated so many black people. They almost didn't care what he did, what Obama did wrong. I know this is all emotion, but it was so, the rejection of Obama by Republicans, was so total and so consistent, there was a great anger amongst black people about this. And so when he did made legitimate mistakes, drones were more than that. It's almost like we couldn't process that. Like, but what about that opposition? And there are people I talked to who believed if he had had more cooperation, a little more cooperation with Congress, he would have followed the better angels of his nature and not done certain things, or he might have had better counsel, or this is a big what if. But I think that the opposition that was set up from day one of his administration in 2009, that announcement by Republicans, our goal is to get him out of office and not to listen to anything he says, that really set the tone, set the template for the cultural atmosphere. And that never really diminished. I actually heard some Republicans say this year, the beginning of this year, 2016, we've got to get him out of office. Well, he's almost out of office. He's almost gone. And so the intensity of the opposition never waned. In fact, it just got stronger. And that was really a distraction from actually a lot of the points you're making. I'm not saying it gave Obama a cover for a lot of the missteps he made, but overshadowed a lot in the minds of a lot of black folks. And I understand that it was hard to make that real critical analysis when we felt Obama was being treated so unfairly. So that's just the kind of the way it went down.
Yeah, there's someone you quote in the book who says, quote, "I know it's hard for people to look at drones, to look at why he doesn't do this thing or that thing, but the tightrope is one he has to walk. I have a friend in the South who says she's seen bars with calendars on the walls that count down the days to when Obama gets assassinated." Mm-hmm. End quote. I'm sure she has. I don't doubt it for a minute. But the thousands of innocent people who've been murdered with drones and this policy that's been created that will be handed on to the next president who won't be black and may be on the bad team instead of the good team, and the other countries around the world that are developing the same policies of murder anybody anywhere with drones. I mean, all of those lives are in the balance when we say we're going to blindly cheer for somebody because somebody else hates him.
I would say there was no blind cheering. I don't think anybody felt good about the drone.
Well, what does a calendar on a wall in a bar have to do with your position on killing people with missiles from drones?
Well, it has a lot to do with what I just mentioned, which is that there was such clear and consistent opposition to Obama politically that that took a lot of our attention and our energy away from, I guess, what you call just a very clear-eyed analysis of things, you know, things that needed to be analyzed. And I'm not saying people were not aware of these things, but they really felt, a lot of black folk I talked to felt the real overarching problem was how Obama was his lack of cooperation, was not just not lack of cooperation, lack of respect. And that was very important to people. It just was not just lack of respect. That sounds too mild. This hatred that played out in public, and it really bothered people. And quite frankly, it just didn't blind them to certain things. To the things, you know, you talk specifically about drones and people being killed. It's not blind them to those things, but it made it more difficult to make that the most important thing. I mean, that's just the way it was. And that's unfortunate because, you know, again, another what if. If he did not have so much opposition, if, you know, we could maybe have, we'd be having a different discussion right now maybe about the real issues, the real problems of his presidency. But overall, I think black folk felt Obama was up against so much that, in a way, they didn't totally forgive him the mistakes, but they just did not condemn him for them. You know, that's the feeling that I got.
Yeah, I just, you know, some of us were trying to impeach George W. Bush. We had an urgency about getting him out of office.
Sure.
And we didn't want his powers that he had accumulated handed off to the next president, whoever it was going to be. Mm-hmm. And in comes Obama, and everybody goes silent, and let's give him a chance, and let's not appear racist, and let's shush a little bit. And he formalizes Bush's policies of illegal wars, of drone wars, of lawless imprisonment without trial or charge, of torture. It's not a crime to be prosecuted. It's a policy choice, but we're going to shift to killing people more than torturing them. A bigger Pentagon budget under Obama than any previous president, openly bragging about bombing seven predominantly Muslim countries, predominantly dark-skinned countries, greater secrecy than any previous president, greater retribution against whistleblowers than any previous president, continues the bank bailouts, no NAFTA reform, no Employee Free Choice Act, none of the campaign promises, the health care mess negotiated with the executives of the insurance companies. I mean, if a Republican had done any of this, we wouldn't have just been sort of moderately annoyed but don't want to go over, but we would have been outraged if a Republican had done these things.
I don't know that we would have. You're right. You know, the Republicans, I mean, a lot of this, not to let Obama off the hook, of course, but a lot of this was, you know, started by Republicans. And, you know, so much of what Obama did, at least, certainly initially, was, you know, he's a guy who wanted to bring everybody to the table. He wanted to appear like a team player, but he wanted to bring folks to the table. He thought, I think, part of his One America ideal was that he really could work with Republicans, and he bent over backwards, and that was a huge criticism of him from the left and also from black people in the beginning. He'd given away too much, and I'm not saying some of these moves were not, you know, mainly his idea, but also as part of this, I think his own agenda to win everybody over.
Yeah. Everybody in Washington, not you and me, everybody in Congress.
Not you and me, Washington, right, exactly. And it didn't work. That's the irony, is that it really didn't work. And he slowly dawned on him that you know, it didn't matter what he did, that the Republicans found, you know, the Republicans technically should have applauded.
When did it dawn? When did it dawn on him? He's looking at right-wing Republicans for the Supreme Court. When is it ever going to dawn on him?
You know, I don't know. I really think that he believed, and I talked to a couple of people who actually worked with him on his campaign. He really felt that he could be the guy to broker this, all sides, bring together this horribly divided country, you know, that Bush left to him, and to, you know, make us all come together. Now, he calculated badly, and really, it won him nothing. I don't know, you know, if he was doing this for political expediency or for or to really try to bring folks together. But
just anyway, the idea that he knows better in his secret heart of hearts somehow makes
I
it
really
better
believe,
than if it were someone else doing the same things, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I actually bring that up more than once in the book, which is that, you know, I don't know if you read his own memoir.
Yeah.
This was before he became a political, you know, superstar, so it's kind of more honest than, you know, things written after that. But he has himself, I mean, I am sure, I don't know him, but I am sure that there are a lot of things that he is, well, he's described as a centrist, but I think there are a lot of things, I mean, he wants world peace, he wants people to get along, he's not, I think, in his own ideals, a hawk or anything like that. I think he
went to Oslo and received a Nobel Peace Prize and gave the first acceptance speech in the history of that prize where he said, we must have war. You can't avoid it. Dr. King was wrong. He actually explicitly disagreed with Dr. King's acceptance speech at the same award. And you tell me he wants peace.
To be fair, he did say before that happened, when he was, I think, in the Senate, he was running for, when he was running as a candidate, he said, I'm not against all wars, I'm against stupid wars, right?
Yes, that's exactly what he said.
Yeah, so he never represented himself as a anti-war.
No, he didn't, but you just did. You just told me he wants peace.
Right.
Well, you know, the Pentagon says it wants peace. It wants peace through war. I want peace through peace. There's a difference.
You're right, there is a difference. But again, he, I think, at the time, you know, he sounded like he was like a breath of fresh air to many people who were, in fact, tired of wars. You know, did not, you know, were
they wanted peace. We all wanted peace.
Sure.
His voters wanted peace.
Right. But I'm saying, I think many people. One of the things that got him into office in 2008 was the complete fatigue with the Iraq War, which, you know, was a huge waste of blood and treasure. And Obama, you know, opposed that war.
Other than voting to fund it every dollar he could get his hands on, and having the good fortune to not be in the Senate yet in time to have voted for it, which won him a primary over Hillary Clinton, who was in the Senate at the time.
Well, you know, you know, these are all really vital issues that you know, you really cannot separate from Obama the figure. But I, you know, what I was trying to do was really get in very close and look at Obama as, you know, I was looking at his residence as a cultural, historical figure amongst African Americans simply because he achieved the impossible, at least in our minds, and that is to become president. Now, one thing I do say in the book, one of the reasons I feared one of the reasons I feared for Obama was that I knew he was in fact taking over an empire, taking over this huge machine called the United States. And what could he really do? What was he going to do to affect change? And that was going to be the struggle.
Well, I think it is a lesson for what voters should not do this time around, and should not double down on the tokenism and the identity politics. But the book is called I Heart Obama. It's by Aaron Aubrey Kaplan. Aaron, thank you for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, what this country calls a war on drugs has never been indiscriminate in its victims. The punitive, interventionist drug policies embraced by a succession of U.S. administrations have hit hardest in communities of color. And in Latin America, it has been the poor, the indigenous, and those outside of power that have borne the brunt of practices nominally aimed at stopping drug trafficking that have only driven corruption and horrific violence. Are things changing now with a bipartisan shift from criminalization to a more health-driven approach? And will any shift mean anything to those who have been and continue to be the victims of what we're now told is widely understood to be a wrong-headed approach? We'll talk about the war on drugs with Asha Bandele of the Drug Policy Alliance and also with Laura Carlson of the Americas Program of the Center for International Policy. That look at the war on drugs is coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at the week's press. Media being swayed by a predetermined storyline is a problem at all times, but one they're perhaps especially susceptible to in election seasons, when journalists assign qualities to candidates and campaigns and then ride that vision till daylight, facts be damned. That seems to be what's at work when CNN reported the results of Democratic caucuses in Alaska, Hawaii, and Washington State, in which Bernie Sanders came out on top. Explained CNN's Chris Moody, quote, "These caucus states, largely white and rural, are the type of places Sanders traditionally does well. In order to win the nomination, he must replicate the success in other, more ethnically diverse states that hold primaries," close quote. Well, that analysis would come as some surprise to Hawaii, the least white state in the country at 25%. Alaska is less white than 44 others at 67%. Washington is 77% white, but then at 84% urbanization isn't very rural. In short, the whole data point is a bust. And while looking through an electoral prism, one might see that as a slight to Sanders, I would suggest attention to, for example, the non-white Hawaiians who see their very existence disappeared in service to corporate media's lazy political narrative. Trump isn't Hitler. He isn't a fascist either, says Newsweek's Matthew Cooper. The unspectacular truth, he assures, is that, quote, a Trump presidency would probably be marked by the quotidian work of so many other presidents, trying to sell Congress and the public on proposals while fighting off not only a culture of protest, but also the usual swarm of lobbyists who kill any interesting idea with ads and donations, close quote. Cooper says readers need only remember Schoolhouse Rock to be assured that, quote, Trump is no match for the American political system with its three branches of government, close quote. More than likely, Cooper concludes, a Trump presidency would be, quote, distinguished more by his hue, his bullying and his encouragement of other bullies, than by any lasting damage done to a republic that has endured far worse, close quote. Feel better now? Well, Cooper's blithe disinterest in any actual victims of Trump's bullying and encouragement of other bullies is concerning, to say the least. But his basic argument that people who worry about a Trump presidency just don't understand how Washington works is also off point. He suggests that thoughts of torture, for instance, or internment camps, quote, would be worrisome if America were Bolivia and not an enduring democracy, close quote. Isn't Guantanamo Bay an internment camp set up by armed forces obeying their commander-in-chief? Doesn't Barack Obama meet weekly with advisors to assemble a kill list of people, including U.S. citizens, that the Justice Department has said can be killed without trial? It really isn't too much to say that a President Trump would start with many tools useful in establishing an authoritarian regime, and that any such impulse would only be helped by elite media eager to wave it away as so much sound and fury. And finally, anonymous sources are to be avoided when they aren't crucial to get important stories out, media tell themselves in their guidelines and their best practices reports. But that seems to have very little to do with what they actually do day to day. A new report for FAIR by media critic Reed Richardson, called Journalism's Dark Matter, tracks a year's worth of New York Times content in light of the profession's long, sordid history of misusing and abusing unnamed sources. In 2015, the New York Times published an average of 4 stories a day using anonymous sources they declared as such. That's leaving out all of the many economists and the some government officials' attributions. The details can be amusing. The source who demanded anonymity because they, quote, always wanted to be an anonymous source, close quote. But the overall picture, in terms of the transparency you would hope for from a profession based on demanding transparency and accountability from others, is no joke. You can find the Journalism's Dark Matter report on FAIR.org. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Here is the quote, if you haven't heard it, attributed by a recent story in Harper's to John Ehrlichman, domestic policy advisor to Richard Nixon, referring to Nixon's declaration of a war on drugs. Quote, "You want to know what this was really all about? The Nixon campaign in 1968 and the Nixon White House after that had two enemies, the anti-war left and black people. You understand what I'm saying. We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or black, but by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and blacks with heroin, and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did." Close quote. Well, a Huffington Post story on the quote showed an update, noting that some of Ehrlichman's former colleagues say he never said that, and if he did, he was being sarcastic. But our question might be, what difference does it make? Has the war on drugs been less of an assault on black communities, as well as social justice activists, if we don't have such a smoking gun admission? Here to help separate words from reality when it comes to racism and the drug war is journalist and author Asha Bendele, who is Senior Director of Grants, Partnerships, and Special Projects at Drug Policy Alliance. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Asha Bendele.
Thank you so much. Hello, hello.
You get the patronizing vibe from its headline. Was Nixon's war on drugs a racially motivated crusade? It's a bit more complicated. This is a piece by Vox.com that ties itself into a pretzel, saying that Nixon was racist, but you have to keep in mind that also he personally despised drugs to the point that it's not surprising he would want to rid the world of them. But here's the big finish. None of that means that the drug war hasn't disproportionately hurt black Americans. It clearly has. But the lessons of Nixon's drug policies may not be so much that he was a racist, power-hungry politician, although, again, he was, but rather that even well-meaning policies can have big, terrible, unintended consequences. Well, I'm not going to ask you to make actual sense of that, but instead to talk about this useful confusion, if you will, the idea that a set of policies and practices can't be properly described as racist unless you can show evidence of explicitly racist intent. How much should it matter what Ehrlichman said?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it matters somewhat, but I'm not intent on looking at that, right? I think that we look at every drug law that's been started in America, and it's always been tied to race. When you were talking about the first opiate laws. Those were against Chinese people. The first cocaine laws are against black people, with the New York Times screaming about the Negro cocaine menace, you know, describing the Negro from the South in much in the same ways we heard Mike Brown described when Darren Wilson shot and killed him, that he was lurching toward him. He couldn't stop him. You had to shoot down and kill this big, unstoppable black monster. And, of course, marijuana laws targeted in particular Mexicans who were coming into the United States. And so you see that in all of these cases, there's a fundamental tie-in, and that's around economic policy, right? They were worried about blacks coming up from the South and taking jobs, the Chinese men who were here building the railroad, and what else would happen after that was gone, or Mexicans coming up from Mexico and taking jobs. So there's never been a drug law that's been started in the United States that wasn't explicitly tied to race and wasn't around race. When you had white women who were using opiates to soothe their pain in the 1800s, there was never any laws against them. They were treated as people who needed public health intervention, if in fact they were using it in a way that was deleterious to their lives, and much in the same way we see that now, right? So now we're getting a kinder, gentler drug war because they're concerned that white people are dying of opiate overdose. And we didn't have that, and there's been no plan to talk about what are they going to do to repair the harms that have been done to people who were criminalized. And, you know, when it comes to black people and Nixon, I will say this. We do know that Nixon participated in various counterintelligence-type programs, including Project New Kill comes up under his administration, and all these ways to disrupt black people and activists in general. And it strikes me that the war on drugs begins right at the time under Nixon that black people really had the world looking at us and looking at the human rights violations that have been going on in America for so long against black people, right? We're at the height of that, the civil rights movement coming to a close, and really now that we've gotten civil rights, how do we demand full human rights, which is what the Black Power movement was doing. And so right as that's happening, Nixon finds a way to criminalize a whole swath of the American populace, the African-American swath of the American populace. There's so many lies tied up in it that we even begin to believe that the kind of misinformation that's put out, not just about drug users, but about drugs themselves, right? So you have marijuana as a Schedule I drug. You have 10, 15 years later, all the lies about crack that are put out that would really have been debunked at this point by people like Dr. Carl Hart. But, you know, that's really what happened. At a moment when we held the moral high ground, we were all criminalized.
Well, and I think the confusion about saying that just because you can say that policies are about something in addition to race, that that somehow means that race and racism are not irreducible factors in those policies. Well, you're talking about the shift in new compassionate outlook as the demographics, if you will, or perceived demographics of drug use change. The New York Times ran a piece last September with the headline, "In Heroin Crisis, White Families Seek Gentler War on Drugs." And the reporter laid it out, you know, when the nation's long-running war against drugs was defined by the crack epidemic and based in poor, predominantly black urban areas, the public response was defined by zero tolerance and stiff prison sentences. Today's heroin crisis is different, and so on to talk about the compassionate approach. Now, I take issue with the phrase, the public response. People don't make drug policy, mm-hmm. but they are pointing to race as being a driver in this new compassionate approach to heroin. But what I wanted to get to is, in that piece, there's an explanation given by Michael Botticelli, who heads the White House Office of Drug Control Policy, and he suggests that the reason these white and sometimes middle class heroin addicts are getting a compassionate approach is their families and communities know how to politically organize and demand that kind of response, as if to suggest that if black people had only organized about the harms of the drug war, or as if to suggest that black people did not organize about the harms of the drug war, and that's why that approach was different.
Number one, the only relationship that black people have continuously had to the government of the United States is a relationship of confinement and containment, right? Whether it was chattel slavery, whether it was the terrorism imposed by the Ku Klux Klan, the Jim Crow laws, and then immediately following that, those end officially in 1968. Nixon starts the drug war in 1971, or the modern drug war in 1971, which begins the climb from 200,000 people in the prison system then to over 2 million now, and another 5 million on paper, as we call it, right, still being monitored by the criminal justice system through parole, probation, and whatever, their citizenship not fully intact. So there's never been a relationship, and I don't even know that America and the people we have in leadership now fully know how to create a relationship with black people that is not bounded by that fact. And that's what we're pushing against. But when it comes to what Botticelli says, it's extraordinarily insulting. It's a black woman who leads the first and successful raid during the Civil War. That's Harriet Tubman. There's always been resistance to oppression by black people. Now, the response has been extraordinary, right? We remember the first SWAT raids were leveled against the Black Panther Party in Los Angeles, right? So those weren't done to, like, take down a whole bunch of criminals. Those were activists they used it against. It was activists in Detroit who had tanks rolled on them, and it was activists in Baltimore and in Ferguson who had tanks and rubber bullets. It was the police who started that violence against young people primarily who were protesting another murder of another one of our own at the hands of police. So we've always resisted. The response to that resistance, the response to that organizing against oppression and against state violence has been extraordinary.
Well, let me ask you on another tip, because I think people think, you know, the winds of change are in the air. And one of the things people would point to is the decriminalization in many states of marijuana. Does that marijuana decriminalization automatically bring with it an improvement in the lives of black and brown people?
Marijuana was decriminalized in my city, New York City, in 1977, and yet arrest rates went skyrocketing. Until de Blasio gets in office, there's an extraordinary skyrocket in the arrest for marijuana. So that's no guarantee. I think in some places, like Washington, D.C., where there was a full-out legalization, you saw a precipitous drop, I think, you know, really almost down to zero in arrest rates. And I think legalization may allow us to get toward that level where, you know, drugs are fully taken out of the criminal justice system. Decriminalization is helpful, but it's not the full answer for something that, you know, you can't use legislating morality, right? And deciding what drug is licit and what drug isn't licit. And it really makes no sense. If you were to take pure acetaminophen into your body, it's actually more toxic to your body than pure heroin. So it's not like we do this stuff based on science or based on public health or public safety. That's not what happens. In fact, the laws we create generate public danger. Prohibitionist policies generate public danger. They generate underground markets. They generate all of that, just like they did during alcohol prohibition. I don't know that that's the full answer. I look more toward where legalization has had a better impact. And then that's only one part of the equation there, because even with legalization, are we talking about full economic justice? Are we still talking about economic violence where people are locked out of any systems of wealth creation and stabilizing their families?
Right. Well, and the key factor there being that in many of the states that have legalized marijuana, if you have a drug-related felony conviction, you can't open that cannabis-related business, you know, so that's going to close that path for a lot of people who were victimized by the drug war. Now things have changed, but they will not be on the winning team in terms
of... And even if you get that, what percentage of the money that's made by an above-ground licit market now in marijuana or anything else that comes down the road is going to go to repair the harms? This is a moment for repairing the harms. It's a moment for reparations, which people don't want to think about, but it's hard to speak to people's intent, right? We think that we know their heart. Maybe we do, maybe we don't. I'm going to speak to just the outcomes and the policies, and I'm interested in changing people's behavior on this stuff. And when this is the outcome of what you did, you have to pay a price. Communities were destroyed. Families were destroyed. People were locked out of having any kind of jobs when they came home. They were locked out of being able to go to school. You have to hold people accountable for that.
We've been speaking with Asha Bendeli of the Drug Policy Alliance. She's author of The Prisoner's Wife, among other titles, and you can find the Alliance online at drugpolicy.org. Asha Bendeli, thank you so much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you so much. It was such a pleasure to be here.
The impact of the U.S. war on drugs is not felt only in the United States, of course, and there is a vivid effort now underway to call attention to that fact. Our next guest is part of the Caravan for Peace, Life, and Justice, traveling through Central America and Mexico to New York. Laura Carlson is the director of the Americas Program of the Center for International Policy, based in Mexico City. She joins us now by phone from Honduras. Welcome back to Counterspin, Laura Carlson.
Well, thanks so much, Janine. It's a pleasure.
Well, tell us, what is Caravan 2016? What is it itself? And then what is the message?
Well, the Caravan is an initiative that's been in the process of organization for months now. And the idea is we started in Tegucigalpa in Honduras, and we're going through 5 countries, Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala, Mexico, and the United States, to end up on the 19th of April at the United Nations Special Session on Drugs. And the idea is to open the debate on prohibition policies and the war on drugs. And as we go through the different towns and cities and countries that we're visiting along the way, what we're hearing are scores of testimonies as to the specific and very concrete impact of the war on drugs policy in these countries. Of course, we chose Central America and Mexico because the violence that's generated by this war mentality in respect to the enforcement of prohibitionist policies is so keenly felt in these countries. And although we've only been on the road now for several days, we've already heard many accounts of this. After starting in Tegucigalpa with human rights groups and hearing the problems that they're facing in terms of human rights violations and the direct impact of militarization, we then went to the Atlantic coast with the indigenous population of mostly Afro descendants there, and they have a particular perspective on it. They are very clear about asking the United States to withdraw all support for this militarization policy and for the Honduran security forces, because one of the classic cases was several years ago, their population suffered a massacre in Aguas that was actually carried out by a State Department helicopter with DEA agents on board and Honduran military that apparently mistook a boat full of Garifuna indigenous people and mestizo-indigenous people for drug traffickers and just began shooting in the pre-dawn hours. There's no full investigation and there's no prosecution. They've suffered several assassinations since then. They joined the caravan and then went from there to the town where we are right now, where the environmental activist Berta Cáceres was assassinated. The relationship is that this repressive apparatus of the war on drugs that's supposedly aimed at breaking down the drug cartels is actually being turned against grassroots movements, and particularly grassroots movements like Berta Cáceres and like the Garifuna people that are fighting to defend their land and resources against the incursions of transnational corporations.
Well, what you're making clear here, just in case folks are not understanding it, is that the reaction here and the activism here is in response not just to violence from drug trafficking, but very much a response to the violence of those that are ostensibly seeking to reduce drug trafficking. This is not a caravan that is simply saying drug trafficking and the drug business is bad. It's very much about what we are told is an effort to root out that drug trafficking, but which in fact is not having that effect and is having other harmful effects on communities.
That's exactly right. And the people that we speak to are very clear about this, because there's a number of problems that are rooted in U.S. prohibition policies. And the first is that when you create a multi-billion dollar market for an illegal substance, then you're delivering this huge business into the hands of criminals by definition. And so the violence generated by the drug cartels is also a huge part of it, and it's also avoidable with better policies that are more focused on health. But the other part of it is that illicit drug trafficking has been going on for ages, as long as prohibition has existed. And what the people are talking about here is that it generated a fairly controllable, at least, or low level of violence until the government security forces turned it into a war. And then that destabilized relationships between cartels, it caused conflict in some cases between security forces and the cartels themselves. But it also initiated this era in which the corruption of the security forces, police and armed forces, because in these countries the army and navy are deployed against cartels as well, which is very questionable to say the least in itself. And the contact has created a high level of complicity and corruption so that you have the state actively involved by many indications in the illegal businesses themselves and the citizenry suffering the consequences of the violence that's generated as a result.
Well, how important is the building of international connections and international solidarity? It seems that the national boundaries have kind of skewed our understanding and worked against our making common cause, victims of the drug war in the U.S. and in other countries. The international aspect of this caravan is very important, is it not?
Absolutely. This is one of the major objectives of the caravan. By going through these countries, we're hoping to enable, as people get to know each other who are on the caravan, as people on the caravan get to know the grassroots organizations in the other countries, to enable more linkages between people who are fighting this policy and asking for more sensible policies based on public health and public safety, to get to know each other, to begin to work together, to begin to see how regional this problem is, to begin to understand the linkages that it has, and there's already a high level of understanding here, to U.S. policy and the extremely high levels of the sales of arms and military and defense and security aid from the United States that's going into perpetuating this war. And on the other side, it's been already one of the most wonderful outcomes of the caravan to see that the appreciation of peoples like the Garifuna, like the Lenca people here in La Esperanza, when the caravan arrives, what it means to them to know that in other places of the world, there's an understanding of what they have to go through, the risks they have to take, and the obstacles they face in defending their rivers, their lands, their traditional and ancestral territories. So it's an encouraging process for all those involved. And it's a process that we're hoping and we really do think will leave some long-term kind of a basis for continuing to build on.
We've been speaking with Laura Carlson of the Americas Program of the Center for International Policy. Thank you so much, Laura Carlson, for taking time to speak with us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group, based in New York. For more information, you can check out our website. It's fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to a packed show. Scientist Paul Beckwith warns we're in a climate emergency. Glacier specialist Thomas Bosca on the last big temperature jump in a world as warm as ours. But first, let's talk revolution. We hear desperate calls for immediate action, save Earth from climate change hell. But politicians waste time or even deny global warming? At what point would an overthrow of the political system be the best or only solution? When, as Roger Cox writes, is revolution justified? Who is this revolutionary? In the Netherlands, Roger Cox is a partner at the law firm Paulsen Advocaten. He is the powerhouse lawyer who sued the Dutch government demanding a 25% cut in greenhouse gas emissions by 2020. He won that case, setting a precedent for people around the world, and we will talk about that. He founded the Planet Prosperity Foundation, promoting a circular economy, and Roger is known in Europe as a leader in sustainable real estate development, something almost unknown in North America. Roger's new book is called Revolution Justified. Let's talk with him now. Roger Cox, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Thanks for inviting me and thanks for having me.
Is your starting point the conclusion that current governments are failing to avert a climate catastrophe?
Indeed, that is a starting point that we took as a starting point for our legal proceedings against the Dutch government. If you look at the evidence that is out there is a general consensus in the international community of countries, which has also been established once again in the Paris Agreement, that a 2-degree warming of the average temperature of the Earth would be dangerous for humanity and for the ecosystems that humanity depends on. And it's also widely recognized and acknowledged that current emission reduction targets of countries are definitely not enough for keeping us below this 2-degree threshold. So I don't think that there's any denial in the world that we're not doing enough to keep us below that dangerous threshold of 2 degrees. And we took that as a starting point for our court case.
Your book, Revolution Justified, talks about the failure of democracy. Do we need new leaders, or do we need a whole different form of government?
What I mean by that is that if you look at the current political system and our current economic system as well, it's very much short-term based, while solving the climate problem is really a long-term effort, where results will only be garnered at the second part of this century. And that has much to do with the delay in the climate system, in effect meaning that emissions that are discharged to the atmosphere today only have their real warming effect in 30 or 50 years later. So there is a delay there. And that makes it quite difficult for politics and also the market, I think, to deal with this long-term problem, given the fact that their focus is so short-term. Obviously, it's also an international and a very complex problem, so that makes it hard for politicians to deal with it in one-liners, in the media, etc. So there's a lot of arguments that you can make why our current neoliberal policy system and market system is really not up to the task of dealing with dangerous climate change and really solving it. And then looking at our democratic system, it's a system based on the rule of law. And up till now, in the last 2 decades or so, climate change has only been dealt with by our political powers, the legislators and the executive powers, and really not so much by the third power in our democracy, namely the judiciary. So the idea is get the judiciary involved, and the only way to do that is to bring a case to court and ask him to intervene in climate policies, and that is what we did. So basically what I'm saying is I think that we need the judiciary as a third power in our constitutional state and in our democratic system to solve the climate problem and help the political powers, if you will, to solve that problem.
Please tell us more about your case, Roger Cox, against the Dutch government. What did you ask for and what did you get?
We asked for a certain reduction target by 2020, namely a 25% reduction of greenhouse gas emissions, cumulative emissions in the Netherlands by 2020. And that is a target that is derived from an acknowledgement by all industrialized nations of the world in 2010 in the so-called Cancun Agreements, where all industrialized nations like Canada and the U.S. And obviously also the Netherlands acknowledge that from a scientific perspective, it is necessary for them to at least reduce their emissions by 25% in 2020 relative to the levels of 1990. And actually, there's very few countries in the world that have followed up on that scientific finding, those few countries being, amongst others, Germany and Denmark, who aim more than 25% by 2020. But the Netherlands is not, nor are countries like Canada and the U.S. or Australia, for that matter. So what we basically argue in court and have done so with great success is that knowing what needs to be done to keep us below this threshold of 2 degrees and not doing it, so knowingly and willingly keep on contributing to emissions of greenhouse gases that will breach that threshold, is in fact a human rights infringement and is a infringement of the duty of care that a national state has against its citizens.
How has this groundbreaking legal victory in the Netherlands expanded into a movement in other countries?
Already when we started the case in the Netherlands, shortly after, a similar case has been brought to court in Belgium. So that's a case that's now pending for a year already. And it has the same basis and the same claims as we've in the Netherlands. I'm also involved in that particular case. There's a case now in New Zealand that is pending that is a follow-up on the success of the Netherlands. So they're pretty much using the same argumentation as we've put forward in our court case in the Netherlands and transformed it to the legal system in New Zealand. There's obviously a lot of litigation going on by our Children's Trust Foundation in the United States. That's a separate legal action that was instigated parallel to our start of the proceedings in the Netherlands. And there's a lot of interest in other countries, in Norway, Australia. There's a lot of interest in France. An organization has already claimed that they will sue the French government if they don't follow up on the same claim that we've been making in the Netherlands. There's interest in a country like Switzerland. There's interest in a country like Canada and Ireland. So there is definitely something going on. It's obviously a sort of fresh victory. The victory in court in the Netherlands was of June last year. So the fact that we now already have a few other cases pending in the world is very hopeful. And the same goes for the interest that there is in other countries as well.
Well, Roger Cox, let's say the Arctic sea ice disappears, the Northern Hemisphere is hit by years of unrelenting storms and heat waves, maybe crops fail. If a government fails to respond, do you think a violent overthrow would ever be justified?
I don't think that can be justified in our system, and I don't think that that is anything that we should aim for. The revolution that I am discussing is a revolution through the use of our legal system, which is obviously quite a different story. So I wouldn't argue that that is the way forward. But the other side of this question is that, in fact, there will be a lot of, I think, a lot of uprisings that will be caused by climate change and are already caused by climate change in a way, because it has already been established that the crisis in Syria, which has led to the refugee crisis in Europe, for instance, is partly due to climate consequences in Syria in the last couple of years. There have been extreme droughts between 2007 and 2011 in Syria, making it very hard for farmers to grow crops, and a lot of their livestock has died. And as a result thereof, 1.5 million farmers in that country have flocked to the city areas and have become impoverished in those cities. No jobs, no way to get back to the countryside, to the rural areas where they came from. And obviously that is a sort of hotspot for unrest in any community and in any country. So there are links between uprisings and climate change, for that matter, and we will see more of that in decades to come. And I think that is a serious enough development.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We are talking with Roger Cox, a top-level lawyer working in the Netherlands. He says a revolution is justified, but a legal one. Now, you just mentioned really security, and I'm wondering how the problem of energy and climate change threaten public safety, even the stability that we have taken for granted.
Again, following up on what I was just discussing in relation to Syria, you see that there's a lot of security issues already in our country, in the Netherlands, but also in the European Union as a whole, in relation to the refugee crisis that we're now experiencing due to influx of refugees from Syria. And that leads to a lot of political discussions. Should we close our borders once again? As you know, the European Union, one of its main aims has been to become a sort of borderless continent where goods and people can move freely. And that is actually what we have established in the last decades. But now there's a lot of discussion again if each and every nation should start shutting down its borders once again and fall back on a scenario that we've been experiencing till a few decades ago. where there was no such a thing of free movement of goods and people and so on. So there's almost nothing that doesn't have political consequences already in relation to climate change effects. Look at the droughts that a state like California has been experiencing since the last couple of years. Also due to climate change, it affects their farmers over there. It affects the water system, the sanitation system. So there's a lot of consequences that we need to be prepared for that are related to changes in the climate.
Well, you know, I can believe some European laws could be used for a big change, but when we look at the top legal levels of the United States, it doesn't look so good. The Supreme Court has routinely quashed even the most rudimentary climate protection moves made by the Obama administration. How can we find hope there for a legal solution?
Yeah, well, I'm not an American lawyer, obviously, but what I understand from the cases that have been brought in the United States, well, obviously, one of those cases was extremely successful. That was the case of Massachusetts versus the Environmental Protection Agency, where the Supreme Court, in fact, stated that climate change is a real and potentially catastrophic phenomena for a state like Massachusetts and also, obviously, other states in the United States. So it's a real and imminent threat, climate change, according to the Supreme Court. And they've compelled the Environmental Protection Agency to indeed make a scientific finding about greenhouse gases as air pollution, which in the end the EPA also ruled upon in that way. So I think that the United States is one of the first countries where greenhouse gases have been designated as an air pollutant. And there's a lot of regulation that has been coming from that particular case and that particular finding by the EPA. That being said, other cases where companies have been sued by certain claimants, so fossil fuel companies, that is, those claims have been denied, and as I understand it, mainly on the fact that the Clean Air Act in the United States displaces the federal tort law, amongst others, if you will, and our case is mainly based on tort law. But it doesn't say anything on claims that can be made against states as such. That's one thing. And the Clean Air Act, for instance, doesn't displace the Constitution of the United States. So what you see now is that a foundation like the Our Children's Trust Foundation is litigating anew against the federal government, claiming more or less the same things that we've been claiming in the Netherlands, and arguing that climate change will become a violation of the constitutional rights of people in the United States, and particularly the younger generations and the next generations, as it comes to the right to freedom and liberty and so on. So there are ways forward on a federal level and also on a state level. And there's a lot of litigation going on against states, and almost every state, I think, by this foundation, by this group. So there's definitely hope that one way or another, also in the United States, one can find a direction through using the law in order to get states or the federal state as such compelled to do something and do a lot more about climate change. And the same sort of approach would, for instance, also be feasible in a country like Canada, where there is also charter rights that can be invoked as becoming infringed by climate change, etc. So you will have to look at each and every legal jurisdiction and legal system in each and every country, because you will definitely need some different angles in each and every country. But the basic reasoning that our case was based upon can be used in almost any jurisdiction, I would say.
Now, another possible roadblock I thought of was the international trade agreements, which take away national powers to protect the environment. The Trans-Pacific Partnership deal of 12 countries is just one example. It almost seems to me we are going backwards in law. What do you think?
Well, I think that the trade agreements could be and is maybe a dangerous development. On the other side, what one sees is that in those arbitrations where companies more or less sue governments because of change in environmental policies, a new development that one can also see happening is that that those same countries sort of counterclaim against those companies for polluting their countries. So I'm not sure where that will end up, but definitely this is something to be worried about, because in those trade agreements there is a sort of rule that gives companies, I guess, more power to sue a government than it does regular civilians or non-governmental organizations. So there's a bit of disbalance there, I think, when it comes to protecting your rights. It might be very well the case that businesses, due to these trade agreements, have come into a position where their rights might be better protected than the rights of civilians, regular citizens, and environmental organizations. But that is something that we will have to see. On the other hand, I would think that each and every company in the world right now must expect that countries will start to regulate the emission of greenhouse gases much stricter than they do right now. So I wouldn't be surprised that in the end of the day, those claims based on trade agreements will not be successful when it comes to stricter climate regulation by countries. I don't think that a company in due time can still argue that they needn't to expect that new and strict regulation would be implemented. And I think that especially after the Paris Agreement, everybody needs to expect that even companies and fossil fuel companies, that there will be much more stricter climate policies implemented in our countries.
Well, I do agree with you there, but what about countries where the rule of law is fuzzy at best? I'm thinking of China, which can make or revoke laws to suit political needs, or the many countries where laws are made to support oligarchs in power. We cannot sue to save the climate in Saudi Arabia, but we do need them on board. What then?
Yeah, well, my focus in this first phase is also not so much on countries like Saudi Arabia and China, and that is because on an international stage and in the UN Climate Treaty of 1992 and even in Paris and the Paris Agreement, it has been acknowledged that it is up to the industrialized nations first to make the big steps, and that has been the case for almost 20 years now. And that is based on a principle that is called common but differentiated responsibilities. So basically, in the industrialized world, I think that all legal systems that we have in the industrialized world are to be taken seriously and are not corrupt, I would think. And that is where our main focus is right now. So in the industrialized world, the first steps need to be made, and that's what our legal focus is on right now. In the second phase, one would have to look indeed also at countries like China and Saudi Arabia, for instance, and we would have to dig into their legal systems a lot deeper to get a good understanding of how to best go forward in those countries. But that is not something that I've studied already.
Roger Cox, I think laws should protect my descendants, but they don't. Can we change that?
I think that looking at the law as it stands now, and particularly looking at our case in the Netherlands, the court has already ruled that there is a responsibility for our state to keep an eye on the interest of the next generations of Dutch citizens. Because solving the climate issue, again, is something that is very urgent and it needs policy measures right now. And delaying those policy measures, which will make solving the climate problem only much more expensive and will have greater threats to our next generations. So in our case, our court found that you need, when drafting policies, climate policies, you need to take into account that you cannot shift too much of the burden of solving the issue to the next generations as a sort of equity principle. And this principle has also been enshrined in the UN Climate Treaty. And almost every country that I know of does have a principle that basically states that you should comply with international legal standards and principles as much as you can when looking at solving a national legal issue. So I do think that such an equity principle, for instance, between generations, is something that can be invoked and can be argued in court in almost any jurisdiction. So I do think that there are already ways in which we can address the position of the next generations.
And summing up, but two questions. First, what do you want lawyers and judges in every country to do?
Well, first of all, I think that it is very necessary that the legal community as such does get a better understanding of what the climate change problem is all about, why it is so urgent at this particular time. Although when you look outside, most of us will think, well, what's the problem? But that has a lot to do with not exactly understanding what climate science is telling us. I think that they needed to get a good grasp on the consequences that it will have for rights within their national territories. To give you an example, again in 2010 in the Cancun agreements, all nation states have acknowledged together that climate change will affect the enjoyment of human rights negatively in all areas in the world, no exceptions there. So it will have effects on human rights in Canada, in the US, in the Netherlands, in Australia, and not only in African or Asian countries. And obviously where there is a threat, a very large threat, a worldwide threat in essence, on large-scale human rights infringements, it is obvious that the legal community should get involved in an issue like that. So, and I always thought in our case that once we get the court to really understand what the gravity of climate change is and what the consequences will be in the next half of this century in the Netherlands and around the world, that once you really understand that, you will be open as a court for the suggestions that we've been making, is that it is absolutely unjustified and a violation of the law if you keep on willingly and knowingly contributing to creating that specific problem that will create these human rights infringements. So I do think that the legal community, lawyers, courts, academics, legal academics, do need to become much more involved in this issue, and hopefully there will be more court cases that will at least bring this question to court so courts can have an opinion about this issue. And that's also why we started the case. It's just to make it possible for courts to intervene if they think they should, and if they think they don't, they shouldn't, then that's also an outcome that one can live with. But I couldn't live with the fact that nobody was actually bringing a case to court so the judiciary could have an opinion about it. And I think that is the most important thing for bringing cases to court, is to bring the judiciary in a position to become much more aware about this issue and have an opinion about whether or not the law has a role to play in solving the climate issue and in intervening in national climate policies.
We'll have to leave it there. We've been talking with an unlikely revolutionary. Roger Cox is a partner in a prestigious Dutch law firm, founder of the Planet Prosperity Foundation, and he leads in sustainable property development. His book is Revolution Justified, and you can find it at revolutionjustified.org. Get more links for this story in my own show blog at ecoshock.info. Roger Cox, it has been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Hi, I'm Paul Beckwith. I'm with the University of Ottawa, the Laboratory for Paleoclimatology. Although these videos that I put together and the blogs and my website, paulbeckwith.net, if you just Google paulbeckwith.net or Paul Beckwith Climate Change, you can find all kinds of my work on abrupt climate change, on the Arctic, on methane. But what I want to do here is just talk about just some general things about how the overall climate is changing very rapidly, and the human response is completely insufficient to deal with the rapid changes that are occurring. I think we're reaching a point where public is going to go from not caring or kind of tuning out climate change to going into a mode of sheer panic. You know, utter panic over, my God, we're all doomed. You know, we can't do a thing. We've left it too late. And pointing fingers at scientists for not communicating the problem, for not standing up and yelling from the tops of buildings, or pointing fingers at politicians. You know, maybe some of them will even point fingers where the finger should be pointed. And that's really at the denial industry. It's at the heavily funded oil company. You know, large corporations heavily funding people to scream at the top of their lungs saying that climate change, oh, it's always happened. You know, humans are insignificant. We're not doing anything. You know, what can we do? It's a big planet, et cetera. All of this nonsense. I mean, that's where most of the blame should go on stopping action on climate change. I mean, at this late stage, you know, it's amazing to me that there's still denialists. You know, there's loads of trolls. I mean, if there's any decent article in a mainstream paper or blog or something, then look at the comment sections. I mean, it's just swarmed by trolls. Oh, climate change has always happened. At this stage, we should be over this. I mean, these people will go into hiding, I think, very soon when the public reaches the panic stage over climate change. And what's it going to take to cause that? Well, that's a big question. I mean, I think it's coming soon. You actually have some mainstream scientists like Stefan Ramsdorf or something saying, we kind of have a climate emergency right now. Like, you know, what is that? Like, we kind of have a climate emergency? You know, a very strong statement from Mr. Ramsdorf. Last summer, James Hansen put a paper online about superstorms. In the past, we had these massive storms which pushed boulders up very high, you know, on islands in the Bahamas and other places. And this happened when there was a rapid transition in temperature, and we had very large temperature gradients over short distances and, you know, over the ocean. And therefore, we had large pressure differences and very high winds. And these high winds had very large fetch over the ocean and generated these massive waves, which then pushed up boulders onto shorelines and things like that. So this paper came out originally. Well, it was June of 2015 and something like that. And when it came out, I thought, yeah, this is an extremely significant paper. And I actually filmed 9 different YouTube videos going through the paper sequentially, breaking it down, putting it in the context of abrupt climate change. I mean, it covered a lot of things. It didn't cover everything. It didn't talk about methane in the Arctic coming up. It didn't relate the huge Arctic temperature amplification to the jet stream waviness. It did talk about the large pool of cold water south of Greenland and how that was affecting the ocean currents and how it was affecting the jet stream patterns across the Atlantic, specifically causing tremendous storms in the UK and other parts of Western Europe. So this paper passed peer review and was released just recently. And then it's picked up by a lot of the mainstream media, like the Washington Post and the New York Times. These places all ran articles, you know, talking actually about abrupt climate change. You know, climate change can happen over a matter of decades, rapid climate change versus centuries, were some of the headlines. Superstorms are on the way. And, you know, it's a little flurry of press and it'll die down, of course. But we will reach a point very soon when it doesn't die down, when it becomes mainstream headlines. And, you know, I think about 4 or 5 years ago, I said that this would likely happen when we lost the sea ice in the Arctic, when we had this blue ocean event for the first time and people could see on images, okay, we've got no white crown at you know, in the North Pole, no white crown to reflect solar radiation and keep the thing cool, no snow and ice to absorb a lot of the heat. So instead of that, when there's no snow and ice there, that heat raises the temperature of the water significantly. It thaws out the seafloor sediments and there's fracturing and there's methane coming up from methane class rates, which are basically lattices of frozen water surrounding methane molecules. And when the ice is melted, the methane is released. The expansion of volume is 160, 180 times, something like that. And it builds up pressure, and then it can elevate regions of the seafloor, such as what we're seeing on the in the Kara Sea right now. Or if it's on land, it can build up pressure and blow big pockets of earth up and create these massive craters. And these things are popping up over Siberia. We're seeing lots of these. This is a new phenomenon. We've seen lots of these things appearing over Siberia in the last few years. I haven't heard of any in Alaska yet, but it's just a matter of time before they come to Alaska too.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. We continue with scientist Paul Beckwith from the University of Ottawa calling out a great climate emergency.
we are seeing large rises of methane in the northern regions, as high as up in the high atmosphere over the Arctic. There's been a few days where we've had over 3,000 parts per billion of methane recorded by satellites over the Arctic. The methane level is about 1,800, 1,850 parts per billion, global average in the atmosphere. That level ranged from about 350 to 700 parts per billion over the last million years, and we're way above that. CO2 varied between 180 and about 280, 300 parts per million over the last million years, and we're about 405, and we rose 3.09 in 2015 and 2.7, 2.8 something in 2014. Meanwhile, people are patting themselves on the back saying that global emissions have stabilized in 2015, 2014. There's a big disconnect there, and I did a separate video on that. I guess, you know, myself, in studying this problem for years, it still amazes me how we can see all of these articles saying climate change happening faster than normal. Scientists amazed at the melt rates in Antarctica or Greenland. How can scientists continue to be amazed? How can things always happen faster than normal? Like Google faster than normal on climate change and put together a little report. It's amazing. Now Google slower than normal or climate change proceeding as expected, and you'll find almost nothing. So this is a huge problem. There's a problem in the way this issue is being communicated to people in the scientific community when it's completely one-sided. Everything's happening faster than normal. Everything's happening and surprising scientists. And the IPCC models do not account for methane. They say methane is not going to come up, and it's not really, when I say not accounted for, they don't run any models on the case if methane comes up big time from permafrost or tundra or from the class rates in the ocean floor. This isn't in the IPCC models. And in their infinite wisdom, they neglected to consider methane coming up in large quantities. The cold blob south of Greenland, the warm blobs in the Pacific. You know, when scientists start calling things blobs, start to, you know, run for the hills and get extremely worried because it means that they don't really know, you know, what's going on. You know, in the last 5, 6 years, maybe 10 years, I mean, we started to see a change in the statistics of extreme weather events around the planet, the frequencies, severities, and durations of floods and droughts and extreme weather events like this, heat waves, has increased greatly. It's ramping up. The insurance companies are very aware of this. The public is waking up to these problems. We ain't seen nothing yet, baby. The warming in the Arctic is going to skyrocket far beyond anything we've seen. And this is going to really monkey way more with our weather system. Our extreme weather, you know, events and stuff will skyrocket, probably a factor of 10 or 20. And then it's just a matter of time before the public starts to panic over this. You know, in Paris, it's all the talks about a 2 degree, you know, 2's too much, 1.5 above pre-industrial. Well, all of February 2016, we were 1.57 degrees above pre-industrial. In fact, there's a day, I think it was March 3rd or something, when the Northern Hemisphere was above over 2 degrees Celsius warmer than normal. I mean, 1.5 degrees or 2 degrees, these numbers are really meaningless. I mean, the temperatures are rising much faster over the land, for example, than the oceans. But the oceans are warming. They've taken in over 90% of the heat. So, like, we have an emergency situation on our hands. We need to zero fossil fuel emissions. There's no question. We need to do it on the level with the urgency of, the Manhattan Project to build the bomb in World War II or the Marshall Plan to rebuild Europe and rebuild Japan after the war was over. We need to do this full speed ahead. It's not a technology issue, it's a political issue. We're going to be in a much warmer world, and this is all happening on decade or two timescales. This is becoming very, very evident to many, many more people. I've been talking about it for 5 years. So please have a look at my website, paulbeckwith.net, and please make a lot of noise to any decision makers that you know to let people know, yes, we have a climate change emergency.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
We'll be right back.
Before the 10,000 years of stable climate our civilization grew up in, the great glaciers came and went. The climate shifted with them, sometimes warming as much as 5 degrees centigrade within 50 years, we've been told by a recent guest. It's a tough field to understand, and harder still to figure out what applies to climate change today and what does not. Some climate deniers have played on that confusion. But the science of past deglaciation is getting better and better. A new paper out from a team of scientists from the United States, Britain, and New Zealand almost crushed my skull with problems. I wrote the lead author, Thomas K. Bosco, with my beginner's questions, and he patiently schooled me a bit in the patterns of climate change that I did not know. And that's why we've called on Thomas today, educated in Chicago with a Ph.D. in geology from Oregon State. Dr. Bosco is currently a researcher with the Department of Earth Sciences at the University of Cambridge in Britain. The paper that stimulated this discussion is titled Carbon Isotopes Characterize Rapid Changes in Atmospheric Carbon Dioxide During the Last Deglaciation. It was just published in the prestigious Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, or PNAS. Thomas, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for letting me be here.
As a non-scientist, my first surprise reading your paper was that deglaciation can cause a rise in CO2 and not the other way around. Is that true, and how could that happen?
Yes, that's true. One way is through positive feedbacks in the climate system. And one simple example of that, of a positive feedback that we probably are seeing in the deglaciation, is that as the Earth warms, the temperature of the ocean will also increase. And warmer ocean waters can hold less CO2. And one way to think about that is just like when your soda pop gets warm, it will degas and feel a little bit less bubbly. So as the ocean warms, it will actually give off more CO2 into the atmosphere, thus increasing temperatures, which actually then creates a positive feedback loop where ocean temperatures increase once again and CO2 continues to rise.
About 10 years ago, people denied carbon dioxide was warming the planet. They jumped on the science of glaciology to produce the argument summarized as CO2 doesn't lead, it lags. Can carbon levels rise after a warming? And if so, what do you think caused the initial warming that you studied?
Yeah, the cause of the initial warming or the initial trigger for the CO2 rise is still a bit of an open question in the deglaciation. What we think we see when CO2 initially rises about 18,000 years ago is either a switch in ocean circulation or perhaps a switch in the strength of the biological pump in the ocean, essentially a decrease in how productive the oceans, and that released the initial CO2, which then sort of triggered the deglaciation.
And when you say productive, you may be talking about plankton, for example.
Yeah, exactly. When plankton produce carbon in the surface ocean, they eventually die and fall into the deep ocean where that carbon is respired. That carbon is built up in the deep ocean. If, for instance, you have essentially a big shift in ocean circulation, like upwelling of these carbon-rich waters to the surface, you'll get a rise in atmospheric CO2.
Now, talking about this, in email you referred me to a 2012 paper published in the journal Nature by Shakun et al., and the title is Global Warming Preceded by Increasing Carbon Dioxide Concentrations During the Last Deglaciation. What does that paper tell us?
That paper tells us, on the whole, looking at globally averaged temperatures, that the CO2 actually still increased first and drove probably quite a bit of the global warming during the last deglaciation. Now, a lot of other factors are at play, including shifts in the Earth's orbit that control how much sunlight, say, gets to the northern hemisphere, and will, at least at that time, 20,000 years ago when the ice sheets had covered most of Canada, that increasing solar radiation can melt the ice sheets. Because I think it's actually a really interesting point that Shakun brought up, because previously skeptics had called on this idea that temperature rose before CO2 and then therefore CO2 had no impact on the last deglaciation. But largely those arguments were based on the lead lag relationship between temperature in Antarctica and CO2 in the ice cores that we measure in Antarctica. And there are a couple of factors going on there, but the simple one is that's only really comparing one location.
one place on the Earth to CO2. So what Shackin did was he compiled many, many records from both the Northern Hemisphere and some Southern Hemisphere, Greenland, Antarctica, the tropics, and added them all together to figure out globally that temperatures were actually lagging the CO2 rise.
Now, I'd like to shift a little bit in our topic here. Some scientists, in fact, a growing number, worry about the possibility of an abrupt climate shift. And I notice that many of the examples of such shifts given in the past occur during times of deglaciation. True?
That's true. During the deglaciation, and let's just frame it here, this is about 18,000 to 10,000 years in the past. On average, we saw global temperatures rise fairly slowly, maybe 3 or 4 degrees centigrade over that about 10,000 years. Now, some places saw abrupt climate change, and particularly this was documented from the Greenland ice cores, where about halfway through the deglaciation, let's say, at about 14,000 years ago, Greenland temperatures shot up over 10 degrees, probably. And at the same time, we saw a huge spike in the methane concentration and a small increase in CO2 by about 10 ppm over a few centuries. This is one of the intervals we addressed in our study.
When was that?
So that was the onset of the Bolling-Alerod period, which is about 14.6 thousand years ago.
And temperatures in Greenland went up about 10 degrees C in a pretty quick time. You said two abrupt climate changes were likely driven by changes in land carbon. What does that mean?
When we investigated a few of the times that CO2 was rising fairly rapidly, and when I say rapidly, that's rapid for a geologist. So we're talking about changes of about 10 ppm in CO2 over a few centuries. And to put that in some context, you know, we've had a CO2 rise of over 100 ppm in just the last century. So it's fast for a geologist. It's relatively actually slow and a small change, I'd say, compared to the anthropogenic influence of the present day. But when we saw some of these small rises in CO2 of about 10 ppm, we also saw that the carbon isotopes, which can fingerprint different sources of CO2, also changed quite rapidly. And they were changing in a direction that was saying that the CO2 might be coming from the land biosphere, and that would be things like land plants or carbon that's stored in soils.
Right. I'm thinking during the times when the glaciers were around, it was also pretty dry, was it not?
That's what you would say globally. Colder air can hold less water vapor. You know, this is just like in the wintertime, the air is drier and colder.
Plus, a lot of the world's available water got sucked up into the glaciers and stored there. So the reason I bring that up is because if, as the glaciers advance and that period advances, then land plants die, obviously. They're going to give up their carbon. There's a carbon balance happening there that I haven't totally grasped yet.
Yeah, so let's go back in time to the time when the ice sheets were big during the last glacial maximum, about 20,000 years ago. At that time, probably lots of carbon from land had been essentially scraped off the continents, let's say, and dumped into the ocean. Then as the ice sheet pulled back, you know, you can think of the boreal forest in Siberia or over Canada, eventually grew back and redeveloped soils. So on long time scales, you know, in and out of ice ages, you have this waxing and waning of carbon on land. But what was kind of interesting was that during the deglaciation, you might have had a little burp, essentially, of land carbon make its way to the atmosphere in a few centuries. And we looked at other climate records then to figure out where this land carbon could be coming from. And what we saw was at the time, there are records of climate from the tropics, from speleothems, essentially stalactites and stalagmites that grow in caves, can record how wet the cave system was and or how much rainfall there was over the tropics. And we saw at that same time, the strength of the monsoons was very, very weak. So the possible idea is that there was maybe a cooling and widespread drought in the northern hemisphere, and that's what released a little bit of more CO2 to the atmosphere.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Thomas K. Bosca, a researcher at Cambridge University in the UK. We're talking about what we can learn and what we can't from new science on disappearing glaciers. Thomas, I know some listeners will be thinking, Greenland is melting rapidly now. Parts of Antarctica are too. Mountain glaciers all over the world are retreating. Are we not in a period of deglaciation now?
Yeah, that's an interesting way to think about it. One way to put it in context is that during the last ice age, we had a huge ice sheet that extended from essentially northern Canada all the way to Chicago, New York City, and that the total amount of more ice that was on the planet at that time was able to draw sea level down by about 120 meters or so. Now, in the future, we are looking at very significant rises in sea level, perhaps on the order of a meter over hundreds of years, but we won't be able to have the same magnitude change in sea level that we see on glacial interglacial cycles because there's just not as much ice left, essentially, on the planet compared to what there was in the Ice Age.
Okay, let's get right to your paper. What was your team trying to determine?
What we were trying to do was essentially fingerprint the sources for CO2 during the last deglaciation. So almost over 30 years ago, essentially in the 1980s, the first measurements from ice cores came out, and they pointed out that CO2 was probably lower during the last ice age. And over time, we refined the measurements, made better and better records of this rise in CO2. And it's been extremely important for understanding how the climate system works, because in order to predict the future, we have to have some understanding if the models are working. And a big target for models to see if they're getting their physics right and all and everything that goes into them is to study what the climate was like during the last ice age. And one really important thing to understand then is to how much lower CO2 was during the ice age.
How much lower was it?
CO2 during the last ice age was as low as 190 or so ppm. Now, to compare that, then, during the deglaciation, it rose about 80 ppm over at least 8,000 years. Now, to give that some context, though, we've already seen CO2 rise over 100 ppm over the last century. So it's a much slower change in CO2 than we're seeing today, but it's still an interesting time to understand how the Earth can transition from one climate to the next as CO2 changes.
How were your ice samples gathered, and what did you use to measure the state of CO2?
We actually found a fairly unique site to gather these ice samples. So probably your listeners are maybe familiar with ice cores and can imagine that generally we go to the very top of the ice sheet in Antarctica or Greenland and drill down to get older ice. But here we wanted to get very, very large samples of ice to measure gases that we can't get, because even in a deep ice core, the ice is very precious. So the other place, not only is there old ice deep in the ice sheets in Antarctica, but actually eventually that ice makes its way back to the surface, and most of it's lost in the form of icebergs. But some of it actually reaches the surface and outcrops on glaciers. So we went to this very special place called the Dry Valleys of Antarctica, and it's called the Dry Valleys because the conditions are very, very unique there, that as this ice flows out towards the sea, instead of melting or calving as iceberg, it actually sublimates, that is, you know, turns directly from a solid, essentially, to a vapor. So you have these large valleys in a few unique places in Antarctica that are free of ice, not because it's melting, but actually because it's sublimating. And so we went to this Taylor Glacier and in this Dry Valleys and actually found very old ice on the surface, and were able to essentially mine the ice and get almost unlimited sampling to take home back to the laboratory.
And then looking at the puzzles uncovered by this new research, your team attempted to come up with explanations, and most of those come from changes in the state of the ocean or ocean life. Can you talk a bit more about that, Thomas, please?
Yeah, there's a few hypotheses for what drives glacial and interglacial CO2. One of the things is that the theories behind glacial and interglacial CO2 are very, very diverse. And generally, what we think is that the ultimate drivers behind the CO2 rise are going to be complex, and they're actually going to be a combination of different things.
Let's go from that, because I think one of the things that I got from your email and from your paper is that you found a lot of possible pathways and drivers, and I think that's the most challenging part of your new science. You don't find a single mechanism to explain, but a very complex system that feeds back on itself, and that's part of the problem of communicating this science, would you say?
Yeah. I think the idea of feedbacks might be an interesting way to frame it. So essentially what we found during the deglaciation is that overall CO2 rises in two kind of distinct phases. And this is reflected in the carbon isotopes. So the earliest part of the CO2 rise, where it rose about 30 ppm over, let's say, 1,000 years, must have been sourced from organic matter that was in the deep ocean. Now, how this carbon got out of the ocean is still not known exactly. One theory is that the carbon was upwelled through stronger ocean currents. Possibly the driver of these ocean currents actually was the atmosphere. So around Antarctica, there's extremely strong current that surrounds the continent, and that's driven by winds. Now, one trigger for this CO2 increase could have been stronger winds, which then drove stronger upwelling, which then pulled carbon out of the deep ocean and brought it to the atmosphere. A kind of second idea is that maybe it's driven by changes in productivity. So the other thing, interesting thing about the ocean around Antarctica, this is called the Southern Ocean, is that the organisms that grow on the surface need iron to be productive. And at the same time of the initial CO2 rise, we also see a decrease in the flux of dust to Antarctica, and presumably at the same time the flux of iron that comes with this dust, terrestrial dust. So the other idea is that there was a decrease in dust to the Southern Ocean, a decrease in iron, and therefore a decrease in productivity, which had then allowed more CO2 to get out of the ocean and reach the atmosphere. Now, in the second phase of the CO2 rise, which occurs in the later part of the deglaciation, we see a different change in the carbon isotopes. And what possibly is going on there is that, well, we still probably have further release of CO2 from the oceans through biological processes, but the isotopes also tell us that ocean warming becomes more important for the CO2 rise in the latter half of the deglaciation. And that's kind of interesting, because that's saying there's a feedback there where maybe the initial trigger for the rise was a change in ocean circulation, but then as more CO2 got in the atmosphere, it warmed the oceans, and that ocean warming then released more CO2. And when you add those things up, those feedbacks together can therefore drive a deglaciation.
You know, in our email exchange, you were discussing the importance of changes in ocean currents, and then you put the word climate in quotation marks, and that sent me off on a tangent wondering what we really mean by climate. We're talking about the deep relationship between the ocean, which is not part of the atmosphere, and what happens in the atmosphere. I think the public is confused about this as well. How do you define climate?
Well, a lot of times when we talk about abrupt climate change in the paleoclimate record, we're talking about rapid temperature changes in some regions, perhaps different things happening in other regions. And an example of this actually occurs during the deglaciation. So 14.6 thousand years ago or so, Greenland temperatures rapidly increased. Now, at the same time, we know from the ice cores in Antarctica, which we can synchronize with the ice cores in Greenland, that Antarctic temperature started to cool. So 14.6 or so thousand years ago was a period of an abrupt climate change. There wasn't at least a large global increase in temperatures. Rather, the northern hemisphere seemed to warm, while the southern hemisphere seemed to cool. And the leading hypothesis for this is that actually you're having a switch in ocean circulation, because the oceans can drive how heat is distributed between the hemispheres. So the idea actually is that 14.6 or so thousand years ago, essentially a conveyor in the ocean circulation system started to bring more heat and push it northward, which is why Greenland warmed. While at the same time, it was stealing heat, essentially, from the southern hemisphere, and that's why Antarctica starts to cool.
Now, one caution I think that I've sensed from you is that some things that happened during deglaciation just don't apply to our situation today. Can you give us an example of a feedback or an event found in times when the great glaciers were melting that would not apply today?
Yeah, that's a good question. One example is we believe that some of these changes, these abrupt climate changes in the past in ocean circulation, were probably ultimately driven by a flux of fresh water into the ocean. In the case, the rather abrupt CO2 rise about 16.3 thousand years ago, where we think it could be driven by a release of land carbon, and we think that land carbon itself was driven by a cooling and perhaps drying of the northern tropics. The ultimate cause of that climate change, we don't really understand it, but actually the most interesting correlation we found and published on earlier was that this cooling and drying seems to occur when there was a Heinrich event. And a Heinrich event, Heinrich events are observed in the ocean sediments in the North Atlantic. And there are periods when you find sediment in the North Atlantic that you could only get if there were icebergs, large icebergs, being transported from far north into the very far south. So these Heinrich events are often thought of as these large iceberg armadas, essentially, being released from Hudson Strait, being released from the Laurentide ice sheet, which was the largest ice sheet during the last ice age. And that ice sheet is no longer there. So we think that it's unlikely that these kind of mechanisms can occur today because we just don't have the same ice sheet configuration, essentially. We don't have the large northern hemisphere ice sheets anymore.
And conversely, can you think of something from the period of deglaciation that would tell us something about what would happen in our future?
There could be two things. One thing I think the ice core records can possibly constrain is how sensitive land carbon is to climate change. So when climate modelers project how much CO2 is going to be in the atmosphere, say in 2100, the major determining factor is obviously how much fossil fuel we continue to burn. But there are some uncertainties in how much additional carbon come into the atmosphere, either from the land or from the ocean. So actually, when you try to project out temperatures for, say, the next 100 years or so, you have to take into account how the carbon system is going to respond to anthropogenic climate change. So one way to constrain that then is to look to the past when we have natural climate variability and possibly natural variability then in the carbon cycle in response to that climate forcing. So one idea is if we do see in the deglaciation that perhaps land carbon is sensitive to drought, for example, in the northern hemisphere, models that attempt to simulate the carbon cycle can use that as sort of a test bed to constrain their future projections. Just to constrain sort of how sensitive the carbon cycle might be.
Well, climate sensitivity is a huge issue today, and it's something that definitely is not sorted out. What sort of research do you think needs to be done to take what you've been doing further?
I think one feature avenue for the deglaciation, as we've sort of been able to produce better and better data constraining the evolution of the climate and the carbon cycle across deglaciation, is to now take our best climate models and try to simulate these changes. Because it is possible that we can try to understand how sensitive the climate is by looking at these benchmarks in the past.
Okay, let's leave it there. From Britain, our patient guest has been scientist Thomas J. Boska. He's doing research into past ice ages at Cambridge University. He's the lead author of a paper titled Carbon Isotopes Characterize Rapid Changes in Atmospheric Carbon Dioxide During the Last Deglaciation. It was just published in PNAS. Find links for this paper and this discussion in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Thomas, thank you for helping us out.
Oh, thank you.
As you can tell, we are out of time. I'm Alex, ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening again this week.
In the atmosphere. In the polar seas.
Oh, why did it get too hot?
The grid went down. Fork is to play.
In the world today. In the world today.
I think now you're listening to Taylor Port, and I know that for sure. And I think we're joined by David Barsamian. Are you there, sir?
Indeed, I am here, Phil. How are you? How are things in Toronto and at my favorite radio station, CIUT?
Yeah, well, you're our favorite guy, so that now we got it going. And we're looking forward. You're coming to town, and we'll be speaking on the 21st at Hart House Debates Room. And you always get good crowds, and CIUT is very, very grateful and glad you're coming. You're going to take up the issue of ecocide, war on the planet. That's a scary topic. What's your approach to this? Tell us about this.
My approach to it is, inspired with a sense of urgency that if we don't get, some very substantial and meaningful action on climate change, the Earth and its many populations and its many, many species will be facing grave dangers in the future. So the time for action is long past due. If you go back to the as late as 1988, even before that, the Club of Rome was issuing warnings about climate change, that the Earth's temperature was heating up and the greenhouse gases were largely responsible for the increase in the Earth's temperature. And here we are, after one climate summit after another, the most recent one being in Paris, where, all the leaders congratulate themselves on how green they are, and then they go back and it's business as usual. The Paris summit, and quoting Canada's own Naomi Klein, was, largely a failure. A failure not because of the wonderful rhetoric that it produced, and it was pretty good, but it really lacks any teeth. There's no enforcement mechanisms to all the suggestions that are being made.
Mm-hmm.
And so once again, we are to trust, the capitalists and that they will do the right thing and act responsibly. Well, slight problem with that. There's no evidence that that's ever happened. Mm-hmm. Where they would, in fact, regulate themselves, they need to be watched and regulated very carefully.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we just had a photo op of, and these guys are very good at it, of Justin Trudeau and Obama, and they're telling us, "Oh, this bodes well." But of course, Mr. Obama, his record—I'd like to hear you think on that. But also, he's leaving office,
We've seen this before in U.S. Presidencies, where in the last few months, all of a sudden the president, gets religion and starts speaking out on, public issues. I mean, he's been in office for, well over 7 years, and he had ample opportunity to act on these things. And this was kind of a love fest, when Justin Trudeau came to Washington. Many commentators here, the commentariat, the chattering classes, commented on how similar Trudeau and Obama are, actually. Not just that, they're very articulate and good-looking guys with, beautiful wives and beautiful children, but they also come, with great expectation, and I'm sure that surrounded Trudeau's selection as prime minister, and certainly was the case in 2008 when Barack Obama was elected. But in Obama's case, he's really woeful in terms of actual performance.
Mm-hmm.
It's too early to judge Trudeau, but, one has to be, I think, cautious, particularly after heinous administrations that have been replaced. So here in the U.S., for example, and I think this is a parallel with Canada. In the U.S., we had 8 horrible years of arguably one of the worst presidents in the United States, George W. Bush, a warmonger, a major war criminal, a human rights violator, etc., who could barely complete a sentence in English that was grammatically correct.
And that's something. Went to Yale.
In Canada, I'm not going to say that they're equal, but you had Stephen Harper, who was, very aggressive in terms of plundering the planet and giving leeway to enormous numbers of Canadian companies that dominate the mining industry, not just in Canada, but around the world. Tar sands development unabated with very little concern for the environment. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people, and correct me if I'm mistaken here, I mean, Harper and his party never won more than 30 or 35%.
That's right.
Of the vote. Nevertheless, because of the parliamentary system you have in Ottawa, he was able to parlay that into 10 years in office. And so their expectations for Trudeau that, you know, there's a new dawn in Canada, just as we had those expectations here in the United States when Obama was elected in 2008. Yeah. The proof is in the pudding. Let's see the performance, not the rhetoric. Yeah. Not the beautiful photo ops and, you know, we love you and Canada is back. Back from where, by the way? It's kind of an interesting question.
Mm-hmm. This is David Barsamian of AlternativeRadio.org. And it's Thursdays 11 to 12. But, of course, he's coming to town Monday, March the 21st, 12 p.m., Debates Room, Hart House. The title of the talk is Ecocide. And he ain't kidding. War on the Planet. I'll tell one last thing, David. I can't resist asking, because I can tell you when you do take questions, somebody's going to want to know what the heck is going on in your country at the moment. Strictly, they're going to ask you about Trump and the violence.
Oh, I'm sure they will. I just returned from a two-week speaking tour in Lebanon, and no matter the topic, be it media and democracy, propaganda, U.S. foreign policy, all these other ecocide and the like, the climate change, almost every single question was about Donald Trump. There was some interest in some interest in Bernie Sanders. Trump is definitely surrounded with a whiff of fascism.
Mm-hmm.
His thuggish nature has come out more and more in recent days, where he's urging his followers to beat up people. You know, this kind of reminds me of things that were going around, rallies with the nascent Nazi Party in the 1920s.
Yeah, the brown shirts.
I don't want to draw, a tight analogy here between Trump and Hitler. But mind you, in the 20s, people were making jokes about Hitler. He was regarded as almost a comic figure with this odd mustache and this weird symbol that he had resurrected from Hindu mythology. Mm-hmm. In 1928, he got 3% of the vote. 4 years later, he was Chancellor of Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Trump represents the absolute worst in U.S. Nativism, xenophobia, Islamophobia, racism, misogyny. I mean, you just go down the list, and he's at the top or the bottom. But he's at the top of all of these, terrible categories. So it's a very dangerous moment. Yeah. And it looks like, he's well on his way to getting the nomination. And stranger things have happened.
Yes.
There's a lot of support for Bernie Sanders here, particularly among young people. But if Sanders does not get the nomination for the Democrats, I have to tell you, there's very little enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
She's regarded as old news and bad news, and she doesn't generate a lot of enthusiasm, even among her supporters.
Yeah.
And she has been very successful at raising lots of money. But mind you, that's lots of money from very few people, whereas Sanders has raised lots of money from many, many people. So supporting his background is much more diverse, and there's many more people that are enthusiastic about Sanders. So, stranger things have happened in politics in the U.S. and around the world. So I wouldn't discount the possibility of a Trump nomination and a Trump victory in November. It would be a very scary development.
Yeah. Well, I think you've sounded the alarm, but on Ecocide, War on the Planet, you're going to be speaking on this at 12 p.m. Debates Room, March 21st, Hart House.
Yeah, and I want everyone to turn out.
They're going to turn out.
It's going to help CIUT.
Yes, we are the main beneficiaries. So we
absolutely. Yeah. And I'm going to wear my best makeup. I'm working on my hair already. maybe tinged with a little blue and a little pink. But I'll be there in living color, so please come at noon next Monday at the Hart House, which is right on campus, right?
Absolutely. It is the central place, and people are looking forward to seeing you. And we thank you very, very much, David.
My pleasure, Phil.
Hug it up. Bye-bye. David Barsamian, and he, yes, will be here on the 21st of March at 12 p.m. in the Debate Room, Hart House. The title is Ecocide, War on the Planet. And, yes, you can bet that they are definitely going to be – someone's going to want – even if they were to start with the issue of the environment, they would want to know, so what's with Trump? And certainly, you know, it's going to look by the time of the fall, when the new president of the United States is elected, the photographs of Trudeau and Obama together and all those, you know, beating hearts that were circling the two of them will just, you know, it's going to be history. And we're going to be in, we're going to have a whole new story. And so that's why you should turn up. To see this, I'm very glad that David referred to Naomi Klein, because her is definitely true. This town and this country has been fortunate to have an author of her power and persuasiveness to on this issue.
This is a Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, and I'm Phil Taylor, your host, and we have three big items to mention today. And number one is, let's congratulate the people of Syria and the government of Syria and the army of Syria for destroying the ISIS element in Palmyra. It's a World Heritage Site. And I hope people know the World Heritage Site of Palmyra. So it's, in a sense, it belongs to all of us. And it had been occupied for, I guess, about a year by the this organization called Daesh or ISIS. Everyone has been in a state of shock over what happened in Brussels, and we have world leaders, Obama, Hollande, Cameron, all of whom say that they want to do something about ISIS. Well, the Syrian army did do something about ISIS. They destroyed that force, which was in Palmyra. And not only had they been in Palmyra, as I mentioned before, a World Heritage Site, but I'm sorry for the echo in, if there's in my voice, if you're hearing one, but that's the way the ball bounces. ISIS not only was in this historic city, the one that goes back thousands of years, the combination that city has been in culture of Persian and Roman elements. It is one of the most beautiful, one of the most remarkable. It's like a spot in the desert. It almost fits with every Western stereotype about the Middle East, in that it's built on an oasis and means so much to humanity. And while ISIS was there, they did their best to destroy, and did destroy, some of the historic pieces that were present there that had been preserved all these years. And it's the world basically stood by, I'm going to say that, about the Western powers, they stood by while this damage was done. And that element is got to be looked at. There's an article that has been being widely discussed in the Independent newspaper, written by Robert Fisk. Many of our listeners will know Mr. Fisk's writing. He's based, I believe, in Beirut. He's a well-known Western journalist who does, I would say, a more than adequate job of reporting on the situation. Now I've got a more happy mic, so one that sort of fits my persona better. So anyway, speaking of Mr. Fisk, he says, why is Prime Minister Cameron so silent about this development in Palmyra? And that's where we all ought to be, is examining the conscience of the West, because when ISIS
across the desert, and it is a desert, a long, long highway, to come to attack Palmyra. The British planes and the American planes a year ago were absent. The planes that have become important are Russian planes. And when it came time to do something about the terrorist army called ISIS-Daesh, I'm putting the slash mark, the West has been allowing a kind of what Charmin Narwane calls controlled chaos. And that explains partly why they're so comfortable or maybe so uncomfortable to not be congratulating the people of Syria and not be congratulating the Syrian army for a job well done in liberating. And that is the appropriate word. It is a liberation that finally now we have forces there that will preserve and protect this World Heritage Site, which is why UNESCO spoke up, and even the leader of the United Nations had something positive to say. But it's Washington and London are rather quiet about this situation. And it's, I would suggest it's a sign of a guilty hand.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Mel Goodman, former CIA analyst, who assesses the challenges of preventing future ISIS terrorist attacks after the recent bombing of Brussels and the belligerent response from Republican presidential candidates that alienate many Muslim Americans. Mary Grant of Food and Water Watch, who explains why the lead poisoning crisis in Flint has provoked calls for federal investment in the nation's public water infrastructure. And Peter Kornbluh, senior analyst with the National Security Archive, who discusses President Obama's historic trip to Cuba and the obstacles for normalization that lie ahead. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The International Criminal Court won a key victory with the conviction of former Congolese Vice President Jean-Pierre Bemba. According to the Guardian newspaper, Bemba commanded a rebel militia in neighboring Central African Republic, which committed mass murder and rape. Over 5,000 victims of sexual violence from the Central African Republic presented their case before the ICC in The Hague. Prosecutors insisted Bemba, who led the Congolese liberation movement, new militia troops were committing these crimes and failed to make necessary and reasonable measures to prevent these acts of violence. The former Congolese vice president was convicted on 2 counts of crimes against humanity, in addition to 3 counts of war crimes in relation to atrocities in the Central African Republic in 2002 and 2003. The conviction was a rare success for the International Criminal Court in Africa, which has faced stiff resistance in pressing cases against political leaders in Sudan and Kenya. Civil rights lawyers have gone to federal court on behalf of the Navajo Nation, charging the tribe's voting rights were violated by San Juan County, Utah. The lawsuit alleges the county's changeover to a mail-in ballot made it more difficult for non-English-speaking Navajos to vote. If a Navajo tribal member didn't receive a ballot or could not understand it, their only option is to drive for hours to a voting place in an all-white community. According to the news magazine In These Times, this is the fourth voting rights case filed against San Juan County. A federal judge recently overturned the county's district lines for school board and county commissioner elections. In the 1980s, San Juan County settled with the U.S. Department of Justice over its plan to impose at-large districts that diluted the voting power of the Navajo people. Plaintiff and Navajo activist Wilford Jones complained the ballot was complex and confusing. The new mail-in ballot worked well in non-Navajo areas of the county, where mail delivery is reliable and voter turnout rose. But some precincts in the Navajo Nation saw turnout drop by as much as 20% in 2014. 3 years ago, police arrested 45-year-old teacher Tammy Bond for having a sexual relationship with a 16-year-old student. She pled guilty and served 180 days in an Illinois prison and was later placed on probation supervision for 4 years. But as a convicted sex offender, Bond, an African-American woman, was required to register as a sex offender. This means Bond can't move back to her home since it was located near a child care facility. Illinois prohibits registered sex offenders from living within 500 feet of a school playground and any facility with programs for children under 18 years of age. While the movement advocating prison reform and an end to mass incarceration is now on the public agenda, there is little sympathy for registered sex offenders who face intense discrimination in securing a job or finding a place to live. Recent academic research has questioned the value of sex offender registries. According to the news magazine In These Times, children are rarely abused by strangers. Meanwhile, grassroots groups like the survivor-founded organization Stop It Now frames child abuse as a public health issue and works to educate adults and communities about prevention strategies. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
After the latest ISIS terrorist attack that targeted the Brussels airport and a metro station on March 22nd, killing 35 and wounding more than 300, Belgian authorities admitted their failure to detect and follow up on warning signs that an attack was imminent. Belgium is well known as an epicenter for European Islamist radicals. More Belgians have joined ISIS as a proportion of the population than have residents from any other Western nation. Many of the ISIS operatives who carried out the brutal Paris attacks in November 2015 that killed 130 were Belgian nationals or residents. The Brussels neighborhoods of Molenbeek and Schaarbeek, populated by many emigres from the Middle East, have been used as a base of operations by ISIS jihadis. While the response in European capitals has focused largely on improving security and intelligence cooperation, the rise of right-wing nationalist anti-immigrant groups has opened up a new front of escalating tension and potential violence in many EU nations. In the aftermath of the Brussels attack, the toxic rhetoric of Republican Party presidential candidates in the U.S. has also been on the rise. GOP frontrunner Donald Trump has doubled down on his earlier advocacy of bringing back the use of waterboarding and more severe forms of torture, while Texas Senator Ted Cruz has called for law enforcement to monitor and patrol America's Muslim neighborhoods, as well as the carpet bombing of ISIS-held territory in both Syria and Iraq. Your reporter spoke with Mel Goodman, a former CIA analyst who currently serves as a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Here he assesses the challenges of preventing future ISIS terrorist attacks and the dangerous response among Republican politicians whose belligerent pronouncements isolate and alienate many Muslim Americans.
I think this attack has created a greater impact than any of the other attacks in Europe. When I think of the attacks in London, Paris, Madrid, Copenhagen, Thames and Amsterdam, and I think it's because Belgium has such a serious problem. Belgium itself is divided ethnically and linguistically and politically, culturally. There are a lot of political hacks that dominate key positions in the government, particularly the interior minister who submitted his resignation, but I don't think it was accepted. Maybe it should have been. There were so many clues. The fact that one of the terrorists was expelled from Turkey and Erdogan gave warning. He was sent from Turkey to the Netherlands and made his way to Belgium, but Europe was alerted to this. The sensitive communications that these terrorists can now adopt, particularly when you have brothers involved. So you can use very unsophisticated kinds of communication. You don't need cell phones, and you don't need technology. So when you look at Paris, there were brothers. Brussels, there were brothers. Actually, if you look at the Boston Marathon, there were two brothers, two Chechen brothers. So this is alarming. And when you look at the fact that ISIS appears to be having difficulties on its own turf, particularly in Syria, but also in Iraq to a certain extent, you have to wonder, and I've seen reports to this effect, that they are sending some of these fighters back to the European countries they came from to foment this kind of terrorism, and that this is maybe ISIS saying that they're losing the battle on their home turf, or at least the momentum isn't with them, but they can do greater damage in Europe and divide Europe politically against itself and divide Christians against Muslims. And you can see a lot of this in European countries that are moving to the right. You see this in France. You see this to a certain extent in Germany. You see it in Eastern Europe, particularly in Poland and Hungary. But all of this, I think, is creating a great deal of concern that Europe, which has its open borders, provides pathways for terrorists, but the borders are not open to intelligence agencies necessarily, and that there's not sufficient cooperation. Germany doesn't want to go as far as the United States has in terms of intelligence collection, particularly surveillance, because they have a lot of laws that prevent them from doing so. So there's a real moment of truth here for Europe. What to do about Brussels? What to do about the social conditions in Brussels that so many of these terrorists came out of one small neighborhood?
Mel Goodman, both Republican presidential candidates still in the race for their party's nomination have responded to the latest terror attacks by a call for more aggressive measures, to say the least. We've had Donald Trump, who doubled down on his earlier statements to wanting to bring back waterboarding and more severe forms of torture. He said previously he wants to kill terrorist suspects' family members. We've had Ted Cruz talk about monitoring Muslim neighborhoods in the United States and reiterating his policy that would have the United States carpet bomb entire cities, inevitably killing many civilians, and then the threat of using nuclear weapons. What is the damage that is done by this kind of rhetoric from these presidential candidates?
Well, this is the kind of rhetoric that ISIS would have written for these people if they had an opportunity, because what it does is it gives credibility to Islamic State propaganda that says the West is conducting a religious war against the caliphate. And this is a tremendous source of morale for these people. I would think it would feed extremist recruitment, and it might even make moderate Muslims or Muslims who are not willing to pursue terror think that, well, you know, maybe ISIS knows what it's talking about. You know, look at what's coming out of the United States. Look at the remarks of Cruz about carpet bombing and Trump, as you say, going after the families of terrorists. And he's backpedaled from some of this, but really his instincts are, as you say, to not only do waterboarding, but to do a lot more than waterboarding, in his own words. So this is exactly the kind of rhetoric that ISIS wants. They want it in the United States. They want to see more of this in Europe. And they're getting it, whether it's Le Pen in France or the right-wing party that gained in the recent elections in Germany. We see some of that language in Poland and Hungary. And when you look at how refugees have been treated and the horrible conditions that refugees have had to deal with, and now this Faustian bargain of sending refugees back to Turkey and giving Turkey billions of dollars to keep them there, I would think all of this propaganda is helpful to what ISIS is trying to do and the kind of message they're sending about the religious war in the West against the caliphate, against Islam.
That was Mel Goodman, a former CIA analyst who currently serves as a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. For more analysis and commentary on the response to the latest ISIS terrorist attacks, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The lead poisoning water crisis continues in Flint, Michigan, the result of a state decision to change the source of drinking water for the low-income, largely African-American population from a reliable clean source to a contaminated one, all in an effort to save money. When Michigan's Republican Governor Rick Snyder and EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy testified before the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee on March 17th, legislators asked both officials to resign, but the likelihood of accountability for this series of tragic errors seems remote. Remediation and replacement of water pipes in Flint will cost millions of dollars to fix. Unfortunately, many residents, especially children, will now face a lifetime of negative health consequences as a result of the reckless decisions made by state officials. If anything good came out of the crisis, it was the interest across the country in finding out if other communities' water was also contaminated with lead. Sadly, test results find that Flint is not alone among the nation's municipalities to have a lead contamination problem, with some experiencing even higher levels of lead than was found in Flint. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Mary Grant, director of the Public Water for All campaign, initiated by the group Food and Water Watch. Here she discusses the widespread problem of lead found in water supplies, steps residents can take to reduce the threat of lead poisoning, and the growing danger to public health as the nation ignores the urgent need to repair and rebuild our aging public water infrastructure.
Lead in drinking water is a big issue in the United States. Lead in school water in particular is a concern because it's often not tested for unless a school has its own private well and is considered its own public water system. There's no requirement at the federal level for schools to test for it. There's also no federal funding for the schools to replace those lead pipes. So what we really need to do is to open up our state revolving fund programs to provide grant programs to schools to help remove lead plumbing pipes and fixtures. The latest survey I saw from the American Water Works Association said that the United States has an estimated 6.1 million lead service lines. So that's the problem that we saw in Flint. They had these lead service lines. They didn't add anti-corrosive chemicals to their water when they switched their water source to the Flint River, which was heavily polluted, which caused lead to leach out of the pipes. Nationwide, we have 6.1 million lead service lines that serve 15 to 22 million people across the country. It will cost about $30 billion to remove the remaining lead service lines, according to estimates from the American Water Works Association.
Some of the worst contamination in schools seemed to be in the lower grades and even pre-K, where kids were brushing their teeth after lunch using that poisoned water.
There is no level of lead that is safe for children. Young developing minds are the most vulnerable to lead poisoning. As they form all these neural connections, they're very susceptible to damage from lead poisoning. It's a very vulnerable time when they're in nursery schools, elementary schools, to be exposed to lead. So we really need to remove the lead from water, especially in those places where you have these vulnerable populations being exposed to lead. It causes a lifetime of consequences for to have that early childhood exposure to lead poisoning. It affects your IQ, your development, your capacity going forward. I know in Flint they're talking about all these support services that they're now going to need to help the children deal with the fallout of having been exposed and poisoned.
Mary Grant, this problem is going to cost billions of dollars to fix, and our government at all levels has not been putting money into fixing our infrastructure. What can people do in the meantime to provide safer water for children? And do you have any idea what percentage of schools or homes have actually been tested for lead? Maybe people are being poisoned and don't even know it.
Yeah, that is a big concern, particularly with schools, because there's no requirement at the federal level for most schools to test for lead. at the home level, if you are served by a public water system, the utility is required by federal law to test a certain percentage of homes that are most likely to have lead in the your home plumbing or in your pipelines to test for the lead levels there. And so they issue a water quality report every July 1st that you can read to see what percentage of homes tested above the federal action level, which is 15 parts per billion of lead in the water. I think that we do need to have the political will in Congress to actually provide the funding that we need. In the wake of the Flint crisis, we're seeing that there needs to be that renewed federal investment in our water infrastructure. There have been several bills in Congress already to provide increased funding, and they're going into appropriations, ongoing appropriations, about what those levers are going to be for this year. So we really need Congress to appropriate the correct amount of money for these dedicated federal funding sources. And then we also need to have a dedicated federal funding source for our water and sewer systems in the long term so that we can have safe and affordable water service. It can be really hard, especially if you're a small or rural system. You don't have the resources in your community to make these improvements that are necessary to protect public health. That's why the federal government plays a big role, especially in small and rural communities. If you can afford it, you can have a filter on your water tap. You can make sure that it's certified to remove lead and assessed certified to remove lead. But, I mean, not every household can afford it. And often that we see the households that can least afford to filter their own water are the ones that are most likely to be exposed to lead because it is an environmental injustice issue that disproportionately affects low-income households.
Do you see this as part of the general failure of infrastructure investment in the U.S.?
Yes, nationally, the American Society of Civil Engineers has given our water and sewer infrastructure a D rating. Many systems have old lead and cast iron pipes that need to be replaced to ensure that we have access to safe public drinking water. Because many of our nation's water systems were built in the early 20th century, and they're reaching the end of their useful lifespan.
That was Mary Grant, director of the Public Water for All campaign, initiated by the group Food and Water Watch. For more information on the group's work to ensure the public's access to safe, affordable water, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. President Barack Obama's March 20th trip to Cuba was a bold affirmation of his administration's historic decision to move towards normalizing relations with the island nation's communist government. Mr. Obama's journey to Cuba, accompanied by his wife and two children, was the first by an American president in 88 years. The initiative for warmer relations between Havana and Washington, begun in December 2014, ended a 54-year period of hostility, which was an important chapter in the Cold War era. The contemporary history of U.S.-Cuban relations includes one of the most dangerous confrontations between the U.S. and Soviet Union, where an American naval blockade of the island in October 1962 over Russia's deployment of ballistic missiles to Cuba nearly resulted in a full-scale nuclear war. The Cuban Missile Crisis was provoked by President Kennedy's earlier support for an exile army's invasion of Cuba at the Bay of Pigs in 1961, and the CIA's multiple attempts to assassinate Cuban leader Fidel Castro. While Obama was warmly welcomed by Cuban President Raúl Castro, his older brother, former president and revolutionary hero Fidel, wrote a column urging Cubans to remember America's history of aggression. For his part, President Obama looked to a future of economic cooperation between the former enemies, with the hope that Congress would eventually lift the 54-year U.S. trade embargo against Cuba. Your reporter spoke with Peter Kornbluh, senior analyst and director of the Cuba Documentation Project at the National Security Archive, who discusses President Obama's historic trip to Cuba and the obstacles for normalization that lie ahead.
You know, the whole issue of tourism and U.S. corporate investment, of course, reminds older Cubans in particular of the 1950s when Cuba was the playground of the rich and famous, run by the mafia and by U.S. corporations. And so Cuba has been really, you know, slow to sign big contracts with big companies. And the Starwood contract is really the first so far with a corporation of sorts And really, that is for a hotel management investment and relationship rather than an ownership relationship. So this is a sensitive issue for the government in Cuba. It's taking its time. Nobody wants to see a return to, you know, the 50s and 40s. So it's a slow but sure process. Raul Castro has said the economy is going to change sin prisa, pero sin pausa, which means in English, you know, it's going to change without rush, but without pause. Unfortunately, a lot of Cubans there would like to see a change rather quickly. So this is a tension in Cuba right now.
Peter, is there some concern among Cubans that with all this change, that the universal health care and universal education in Cuba could be jeopardized?
For one thing, Cubans who have benefited from that, I think, understand that there are a lot of problems with that system still. The universities don't have the resources that they need, even though people have access to the universities. Even though Cuba does have this universal health care system, a lot of doctors are sent off to other countries. There, again, there aren't enough bandages and medicines for everybody. And so even in the kind of tremendous gains of the revolution, the real pillars of what the revolution stood for, there have been great kind of losses as Cuba struggles with its economy. It doesn't really have a benefactor like it had in the Soviet Union or like it had with Venezuela for a number of years. So now the economy has to stand on its own. And Raul Castro wants to see what he calls sustainable socialism, in which Cuba can pay for true health care, advanced education. Part of the problem is that Cubans are extremely highly educated with this system, but then there are no real jobs for them, no real opportunities. And what do? They take their education, creativity, and they leave. And so Cuba wants to change that situation. It wants to control its own future. To do so means opening its economy and modernizing its economy.
Peter, I wanted to ask you briefly about dissidents in Cuba. I believe the ladies in white who generally protest on Sundays in Havana were detained briefly. What's the future of USAID financial assistance to dissidents in Cuba, whom the Cuban government dismisses as really foreign agents of one kind or another?
But look, any direct U.S. assistance to anybody in Cuba is the kiss of death for Cubans. That money really does not go directly to the ladies in white. And I think that Obama people are trying to change these USAID, quote, democracy promotion programs into something that is acceptable to the Cubans. I'm sure that that is part of the various negotiations that are ongoing now between Cuba and the United States that have resulted from the restoration of diplomatic relations and the establishment of task forces to address key issues between the two countries, including human rights and including dissident issues. There's no doubt that the human rights issue became the issue of contention on this trip between the United States and Cuba. Secretary of State John Kerry, as I wrote in the Nation magazine, was due to go down on an advanced trip to kind of iron out a meeting that Obama would have with leaders of civil society and dissident groups, and that trip was suddenly canceled when the Cubans made it clear that they were offended by the idea of discussing it further. Obama did meet with more than a dozen of those leaders, and I think what's very encouraging to them, without certainly saying that he was going to give them any direct aid of any kind, because he knows as well as anybody that that's not useful for them. The Cubans' decision to arrest the ladies in white, you know, literally 5 hours before Obama arrived for doing nothing but actually walking to a given point as a group certainly showed that they didn't want to have the message be that they were suddenly going to go soft because the President of the United States was coming and give an opening to dissident groups. So they maintained their hardline position. You know, it's going to be up to the Cubans, and they certainly know that. I think that the gulf is may well be between the leadership and the people themselves. So we'll see what happens. I think, you know, Cuba and the United States are both their interests are served, both government interests and the interests of the societies at large, by this process of normalization. So I'm hoping that it continues to move forward through the end of the Obama administration and into what will likely be a Hillary Clinton administration if Bernie Sanders doesn't come through.
That was Peter Kornbluh, senior analyst and director of the Cuba Documentation Project at the National Security Archive, and co-author of the book Back Channel to Cuba. For more perspectives on the normalization of U.S.-Cuba relations, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jabal's radio essay.
Eakin, Leakin, and Nod. The name J. Michael Eakin may not be known to those beyond Pennsylvania, but among judges, he was a superstar. For 20 years, he sat on the state's highest appellate courts, 6 years on the Superior Court, 14 years on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, until his recent suspension and subsequent retirement following what has been called Porngate, in which judges and state prosecutors traded photos of a sexual, pornish, or racist nature among themselves. Pennsylvania's Attorney General Kathleen Kane, the first woman in that spot, blew the whistle on such shenanigans, and judges began falling like leaves in autumn. And while the press has been titillated by sexual revelations, the racist comments and cartoons have received less attention. It is thus unremarkable that the court is all white, or that there's also a class dimension at work here. Most Americans, over 70%, have never attended college, judges having first been lawyers are among the most educated in America. Not for naught has the great observer Alexis de Tocqueville, in his classic Democracy in America, called lawyers America's last aristocracy. And as such, they invariably look down their aristocratic noses at their less educated brethren. This, too, was an element in these emails, cartoons, and comics. The high official spitting on the poor, the impoverished, the hoi polloi, the working people. In America, those in power despise the powerless. That's why they are so ruthless when they come before them, pleading for mercy from those who are without mercy. They are all tough on crime until they get caught. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. In support of the efforts of Prison Radio and Noel Hanrahan, its executive director, to raise funds to keep the wolf from the door. If you're a longtime listener to my commentaries, you have Prison Radio to thank for them. In 1992, Prison Radio began recordings from the state dungeon at Huntington, Pennsylvania.
If you walked in on us, you would have thought you were in the control booth of a funky radio station. We did good work together, so good, in fact, that NPR asked us to share our work with them until they got scared off. But prison radio has done far more than pass me the mic. It has given us the haunted voices of jailed juveniles, incarcerated kids, those who are truly rarely heard. It has also told the story of women behind bars, for example, AIDS patients and survivors at the women's dungeon in Chowchilla, California.
This call is from a correctional institution and is subject to monitoring and recording.
I guess you heard that. In short, prison radio has brought you the voices of those behind the walls, the fastest-growing public housing development in America. For this and its other works, it deserves your generous financial support. Thanks. For Prison Radio, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
The Children of Perdition. The recent decision of the U.S. Supreme Court in Montgomery v. Louisiana, which made its previous Miller v. Alabama ruling regarding life terms for juveniles retroactive, shined a harsh light on the systems which utilize such practices, for it comes from the most conservative and frankly repressive Supreme Courts in decades. Nowhere is this more evident than in Pennsylvania, the state with the most juvenile lifers, not in the U.S. only, but in the world. How did this state of affairs come to be? Are kids in Pennsylvania somehow more sinister, more vile, more evil than in other states? Are they more fiendish than any other youth population on the planet Earth? It simply cannot be so. Such a suggestion flies in the face of logic. Why then have juveniles suffered so grievously in Pennsylvania for so many long years and decades? Initially, it should be noted that unlike many other states, in Pennsylvania, there exists no minimum age that restricts a juvenile from the cold winds of the criminal statutes. Thus, they are exposed to the same furies as sustained by adults, as evidenced by the time served by men in the Pennsylvania penal system who were once juveniles, who are entering their fifth decade, that is over 50 years and counting, in prisons. The writer has personal knowledge of a man who was housed with him in the infirmary, who has been continuously confined for over 50 years, is elderly and incontinent. His name is Robert Nash. I hope he is not offended that I'm outing him here. He is a sharp, witty, engaging fellow, but his body is spent. But there may have been a time when such a man, captured in the bloom of his youth, was an outlier, surely, right? Well, not quite. In the 1990s, there came a rush of youth into the state systems around the country, in part occasioned by the bipartisan maneuvers of the Bill Clinton presidency. I will not here restate that case. For legal scholar Michelle Alexander, in her recent blockbuster, The New Jim Crow, has done so admirably with class and grace. What we have not reexamined, however, has been the work of scholars who work to buttress the burgeoning specter of mass incarceration. Here I write of people like Dr. John DiLullio, who was among the first to launch the super predator myth that flashed across TV screens nationwide. The philosophical equivalent of the sky is falling, pumped into the national neural net, erupting into a mad political chorus that congealed and solidified into public policy. A policy of mass repression that targeted kids for decades, consigning them to rural holes of disorientation, disease, destruction, and death for decades. In a spectacular November 27, 1995 article in the Weekly Standard, the very title told the tale, The Coming of the Super Predators. In this work, DiLullio cites prosecutors, convicts, cops, and others to support his essential premise that the children of today, that is, the 90s, are far more fiendish, more brutal, more murderous, more inhuman than any other generation that life has ever generated. In essence, he argued, they are a breed apart. Other conservative scholars rushed to co-sign his observations, as did ominously neoliberal politicians eager to make their mark. This nexus created a firestorm, a bipartisan monsoon of political opinion that swept a generation of youth into the jaws of hell. They deserved nothing, for a la DeLulio, they were super predators. Scholars like DeLulio used instinct, intuition, impression, worldview, and bias to craft something that didn't exist in nature, kids who were monstrous mutations of those who had gone before. And politicians like then-DA Lynn Abraham and her predecessor, Edward G. Rendell, used such scholastic cover to craft a malicious war against children. For they were children, yes, but not their children, and certainly not children like them. They were children of a lesser god, beings of another order of mankind, homo destructus, perhaps, those who needed to be locked up forever. Hillary Clinton joined this malevolent company, and as Alexander has documented recently, she too damned these super predators, her words, to life in cages. For, again, in her words, they're not just gangs of kids anymore. None of DeLulio's predictions came to pass. Indeed, the polar opposite was true. Not only had we not seen the rise of the so-called super predators, but crime rates fell to their lowest rates in half a century. In sum, DeLulio was as wrong as two left feet. There arose a saying in the philosophical community, I don't know, you don't know, and neither does DeLulio. Predictions, it appears, are better left to soothsayers. Meanwhile, hundreds and then thousands of children were consigned to adult hellholes. Some went mad. Some were monstrously assaulted. Some were savaged by older men. And one mustn't forget, given the scandals that arose out of Florida's since discontinued boot camps, these older men were often state officials. But all were traumatized by a theory sold by a scholar who got the analysis wrong, the predictions wrong, the numbers wrong, and his science wrong. But the politics were right, far right, and children paid an obscene price. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Ehrlichman, war on drugs really about blacks and hippies? For the youth of today, the name John Ehrlichman rings no bells. For people who lived through the 60s, it is either famous or notorious. The name references a former high-ranking member of the White House staff, a close aide to former President Richard M. Nixon, and one of the so-called White House plumbers, men who were at the very heart of the infamous Watergate scandal. What makes his name re-ring an old bell is the revelations made some 22 years ago to the magazine Harper's, where the official spoke openly and honestly about the political machinations underlying the so-called war on drugs launched by the Nixon administration in the hot midst of the Vietnam War. According to Ehrlichman, the war was launched as a political tool to attack two radical communities, blacks and anti-war hippies, the youth of the era. It was a political way of waging attacks on both groups without seeming to do so. And it worked splendidly. The war allowed cops, armed with a corrupt law, to kick down doors, raid apartments, lock up people, all in the name of saving them from the scourge of drugs. Ehrlichman told Harper's, did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did. Now, decades after, the press, the courts, the intelligentsia of the nation had signed onto this ignoble, corrupt campaign, the truth emerges. It wasn't about drugs. It never was. It was about politics. Mao used to say, politics is war without bloodshed. How true those words sound today. For the wretched war on drugs, really, a war on the poor, the black, the radical, the hip, has devastated whole communities, created the Leviathan of the world's largest prison system, and hurled countless souls into the hatred-infested netherworlds of prison, probation, and death. That war, still being waged in cities and communities across the nation, was a trick hurled by the late Tricky Dick Nixon and bought into by state government and police powers to wreck dark communities, those unwilling to vote Republican, by the way, in the name of the unjust, intrusive, fake law. That, according to Ehrlichman, was its intent, to disrupt communities, communities of resistance to the state. The war on drugs was lost before it began, because it was all based on a lie. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Has Canada's stance toward U.S.-Iraq war resistors seeking refuge in Canada changed in any fundamental way as a result of the change in government? Is there reason to be concerned if the four war resistors going to court April 5th and 6th are ordered to leave the country? What is the background of Lockheed Martin Corporation, the company to whom Statistics Canada outsourced the 2006 and 2011 census? And why should Canadians be concerned? Is the notion of a mandatory census a breach of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms? Is Lockheed Martin, together with state governments, working to build the infrastructure of a global police state? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we check in on the state of freedoms in Canada. Our first guest, Michelle Robidoux, campaigner with the War Resisters Support Campaign, tells us about four military deserters from the United States still facing the threat of deportation in spite of last October's change in government. In the second half hour, community activist Sandra Finley shares her understanding of the census contract with Lockheed Martin and the implications for Canadians' privacy and Canadian sovereignty. On this week's program, Canada and the American Empire, losing the ability to protect conscientious objectors and private information. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of April 1st, 2016. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Treaty 1 territory in the heart of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. The U.S. falsely blamed Iraq for playing a role in the 9/11 attacks, as shown by a memo from the Defense Secretary, as one of the main justifications for launching the Iraq War. Even after the 9/11 Commission admitted that there was no connection, Dick Cheney said that the evidence is quote-unquote overwhelming, that al-Qaeda had a relationship with Saddam Hussein's regime, that Cheney probably had information unavailable to the commission and that the media was not doing their homework in reporting such ties. Top U.S. government officials now admit that the Iraq War was really launched for oil, not 9/11 or weapons of mass destruction. Many U.S. officials have alleged that 9/11 was a false flag operation by rogue elements of the U.S. government, but such a claim is beyond the scope of this discussion. The key point is that the U.S. falsely blamed it on Iraq when it knew Iraq had nothing to do with it. That comes from the article, Governments Admit That Much of Modern History Has Been Manipulated by False Flag Attacks, by Washington's blog, posted March 31st. Sitting in the Oval Office, Trump will listen carefully to the advice of Walid Fares, who no doubt will advocate for regime change and aggressive policies in the Middle East, as he has throughout the last three decades. Trump will be told of the need to dispense massively lucrative contracts to the private military firms with whom his close advisors Keith Kellogg and Joe Schmitz have long relationships. He'll be cajoled to follow through with aggressive actions that will benefit Big Oil and Wall Street, all the buddies and pals of people like Carter Page. Trump will make deals based on the advice of Israeli mouthpieces like George Papadopoulos, not based on reason, let alone strategy in the interests of the U.S. In practical terms, Trump will likely escalate America's mostly fictional and superficial war on ISIS, embroiling the U.S. in yet another regional war as he puts boots on the ground in Syria and or Iraq. That comes from the article, President Trump, Who's Who in Trump's Foreign Policy Inner Circle, U.S. War Machine Rolls On, by Eric Dreitzer. Posted March 30th, originally appearing at New Eastern Outlook. After Thursday's execution of a wounded young Palestinian man and his friend, who bled to death, was captured on tape, many details started emerging, including the involvement of an Israeli military medic in the crime. In one of the videos that captured this extrajudicial assassination of the already seriously wounded, completely incapacitated Palestinian, the sound of an Israeli colonialist settler, who is also a medic and a cameraman, could be heard saying, quote, "He is not dead. Shoot him in the head," unquote. The second video shows an Israeli soldier executing the wounded Palestinian Abdul Fattah Sharif with a gunshot to the head, after conspiring with an Israeli colonialist settler to drive his van forward to block surveillance cameras and prevent onlookers from documenting the crime. The Israeli medics did not attempt any first aid on the two Palestinians, leaving one of them to bleed to death and executing the other. That comes from the article, "He's not dead, shoot him in the head," quote from Israeli medic, posted March 30th, originally appearing at IMEMC. The Yediot Akronaut Conference, attacking BDS, has become a veritable carnival of hate. But the apogee came yesterday when Transportation Minister Israel Katz called for the, quote, "civil targeted killing," unquote, of BDS leaders like Omar Barghouti. Katz is saying that we won't physically murder BDS opponents, but we will do everything short of that. "We are entering dangerous territory when an Israeli cabinet minister engages in wordplay that verges on putting a bullseye on the backs of nonviolent activists. In this torrid political environment in which Israeli leftists have become criminals and wounded Palestinian youth may be summarily executed in the street, it is only too easy to foresee Palestinian activists like Barghouti having a bounty on their heads." That comes from the article, "Israel Minister Calls for Civil Targeted Killings of BDS Leaders," by Richard Silverstein, posted March 30th, originally appearing at Tikkun Olam. The sole reason that the Islamic State could successfully attack Palmyra was a very large ongoing attack by al-Qaeda jihadists and CIA mercenary forces on the Syrian government forces in Idlib governorate. The Syrian army moved troops from Palmyra to defend Idlib and Latakia, and the forces left behind were no longer large enough to repel the Islamic State attack. The attack on Idlib, for which the CIA allowed its proxy forces to directly cooperate with al-Qaeda, was supported by electronic warfare from Turkey, which disrupted the Syrian military communication. the attack and the obvious cooperation between the jihadists and the Turkish and U.S. secret services was the reason that Russia and Iran decided to intervene in the conflict with their own forces. It had crossed their red line. That comes from the article, Syria, How the Palmyra Victory Changes the Narrative, posted March 31st, originally appearing in Moon of Alabama. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Since January of 2004, American military service personnel started making their way to Canada seeking refuge from a U.S. war agenda in Iraq and Afghanistan that put them at odds with their conscience. The previous Harper government had taken a very strong and even hostile line against Iraq war resistors and deserters. A number of these conscientious objectors have been sent back to the United States, where they have faced lengthy prison sentences for desertion. As this episode goes to air, a number of war resistors' cases are reappearing in front of the federal court as part of litigation initiated by the former conservative government. The liberal government of Justin Trudeau struck a different tone with voters, pledging to deal with war resistors with a sense of compassion and openness to letting them stay in Canada. Yet they have not blocked the litigation moving forward on these war resistor cases. What follows is a clip from an encounter in July of 2015 between Alexina Key, the wife of war resistor Joshua Key, and then Liberal leader and prime ministerial hopeful Justin Trudeau.
While the Harper government deports people like Kim Rivera, mother of four, mm-hmm. to give birth in prison, and they cheered on the floor of the House of Commons.
I was there that day.
When she was arrested?
It was problematic. It was disappointing, and it wasn't worthy of the country that we are. And that's one of the things that I'm committed, among so many other things, to restoring our sense of compassion and openness and a place that is a safe haven for people to come here and build their lives and their futures as invaluable and important parts of our community.
Joining me now to talk about the current litigation facing three U.S. war resistors is Michelle Robidoux. She is a campaigner with the War Resisters Support Campaign based in Toronto, Canada. Good morning, Michelle.
Good morning, Michael.
Okay, so I think a lot of our listeners are somewhat familiar with the cause of allowing war resistors to stay in Canada, but they may be a little bit foggy about the actual process. Now, this is we're talking about people who've been in Canada now for almost a decade. And how many are we talking about?
I believe at this point there are 15 U.S. war resistors in Canada.
Yeah. And how many are facing litigation, the federal court, next week, April 5th
and
6th?
So, yes, April 5th and 6th at the federal court, there are four war resistors whose cases have been sort of amalgamated because the issues are so similar in the cases. And so this litigation was begun under the Harper government and is basically relitigating matters that the court had already found on in favor of the war resistors. So there have been a number of court cases where war resistors have had positive decisions, and this litigation next week will be re-looking at it. The government is pursuing litigation in the hopes of overturning positive decisions, essentially. So that litigation began under the Harper government. And, of course, there was an election in October, and we have a new government, and we've been very actively pursuing the question with our MPs all across the country, asking them to drop this litigation. Unfortunately, so far we haven't been successful, so it is going to court next Tuesday and Wednesday.
If we could just maybe back up a little bit in terms of like the actual process. I mean, if you know, resistors wanting to come to Canada and stay here, they have the option of trying to apply as a refugee or trying to apply for humanitarian and compassionate grounds, if I'm not mistaken. Have those that course has been taken, right?
Yes.
And there's been negative actions and all of these cases?
Yeah, I mean, each case is slightly different, and each individual has a different experience that led them to leave the U.S. military and to seek asylum in Canada. But unlike the Vietnam War era, when, you know, there were many, many draft resistors and deserters who came to Canada and were allowed to stay, they simply could apply for landed immigrant status at the border. And if they had the required points, I think it was a point system at that time, they could be landed right there at the border. That's not the case today. And so individuals like Jeremy Hintzman and Joshua Key and others who people may know who rejected the Iraq War and said they couldn't in good conscience participate in it had only the option of applying for asylum. Now, there are really strong arguments for why they should be considered political refugees, in the sense that the punishment that they face for refusing to participate in the war is not simple prosecution, but it's persecution based on their opinion. And the reason for that argument is one of the reasons is that there's evidence, abundant evidence, that if you are in Canada, you're a U.S. soldier, and you spoke out against the Iraq War and what you saw there, you are more harshly punished if you're returned to the U.S. than someone else who may have gone AWOL from the U.S. military. The vast majority of people who are AWOL or who have deserted, if they either turn themselves in or are caught, are administratively discharged. But U.S. war resistors who spoke out against the war in Canada have been harshly punished with sentences up to 24 months, dishonorable discharge, bad conduct discharge, the equivalent of a felony conviction, which follows you for the rest of your life. So those are the arguments about why U.S. war resistors should be allowed to stay under that mechanism. But there are, as you say, there's also the possibility of being accepted as a permanent resident on a humanitarian basis. And most of the war resistors have been here for more than 10 years. They've been in Canada. They've been they have roots in Canada. They have families in Canada. They have a life here. That's their life. Most of their adult life has been in Canada. And so all of the war resistors have a humanitarian and compassionate application. Some of them have also spousal sponsorships where they've married a Canadian-born person and should be allowed to stay on that basis.
So the remaining resistors are waiting for answers from the humanitarian compassionate consideration and the spousal sponsorship application.
Exactly. And so now that we have a new government, our hope was that all of these applications could be relooked at, because under the Harper government, there was a systematic attempt to interfere in this process, both at the IRB, the Immigration and Refugee Board, and also in terms of direction to immigration officers, who are the ones who decide on humanitarian compassionate applications, spousal sponsorships, and so on. They were instructed by then Minister Jason Kenney, who was the immigration minister. They were instructed to red flag applications by U.S. war resistors specifically and treat them as potentially criminally inadmissible.
So that's essentially like the Immigration Refugees Board has their process, and this directive from the former Citizenship and Immigration Minister essentially kind of trumps their regular decision-making?
Well, in the case of HNC applications and spousal sponsorships, it's clear that if you get a directive from your employer that's published on internet, you can look it up, Operational Bulletin 202. If you get that directive that says these individuals specifically need to be red flagged and sent basically to their headquarters to be treated differently as and potentially criminally inadmissible, I think that sends a very strong message to any immigration officer that your employer wants you to apply this lens to these cases. In terms of the IRB, now, members of the refugee board are, of course, independent decision makers. But again, when the minister at the time spoke out in the media, when war resisters cases were still being decided on at the IRB, and says these individuals are bogus refugee claimants, they are criminals, they are clogging up the system, and that kind of thing. Again, it's an unfair interference in what should be an impartial process. So none of the cases, from our point of view, can possibly have been dealt with on an even playing field in a fair way. And so we want the new government to relook at these applications, rescind that operational bulletin. There's no reason for U.S. war resistors, as opposed to Turkish or Russian or any other group of war resistors, to be singled out, and for immigration officers to be told these cases need to be looked at with a different lens. It's an interference in a process that should be based on the same rules for everybody. And in fact, the former chair of the IRB, Peter Scholler, published a letter at the time that this directive came in, and said that this is an unprecedented kind of interference in that process.
My understanding, at least in the case of Joshua Key, that there was an understanding, a recognition on the part of the refugee board decision-making to recognize that, yes, there are concerns about the Iraq war and abuses that are taking place. But for some reason, I think my understanding is that in the United States, there's the feeling within Canada that they could get a fair hearing in the United States. But based on what you just said, that doesn't sound very likely. I mean, we have the precedents with the people who've already been sent back, as you just mentioned. Is there any area, legally or politically, where you could bring this forward and say, how can you say that they're going to get a fair hearing in the States?
Well, this is exactly what the crux of the issue is for the litigation next week, because this issue has been looked at by the federal court. And in fact, a recent decision in the case of one war resister in 2013, Jules Tendungan, the federal court judge basically looked at the case and said there is evidence that he basically said the U.S. court-martial system, which is different from the Canadian court-martial system, which was reformed, I guess, in the 80s or 90s, but the U.S. court-martial system, it does not meet international standards of fairness. Because of the structure of it, the commanding officer decides on who hears it, on the punishment, all of this kind of thing. So that was a court decision that basically supported what we're saying is you can't get a fair shake in the United States. U.S. war resisters who have gone before a court-martial like Kim Rivera have not been allowed to make the argument that they felt it was morally impossible for them to participate. And if anything, what they have argued about what they saw in Iraq has been used against them to ensure they get a harsher punishment. So they can't get a fair shake in that system. And so those arguments have been the federal court has agreed with some of these things. I'm not saying they agreed with everything that war resisters may have put forward in these court cases, but that's a very significant finding. And that is part of what's at stake with this litigation on Tuesday and Wednesday.
Okay.
So there are other things that the courts have found that also support the arguments that war resisters are making, in particular, the evidence of the systematic nature of abuses of international humanitarian law. These are the reasons why people came here in Canada in the first place. It was because of what the ground truth of the war in Iraq was.
So have you caught the Liberal Party? Because they had certainly made at least insinuated that they would be supportive and of resistors and express compassion on their behalf. Do you have any like ironclad promises they make that they appear to have broken?
I think it's we certainly can't say that they've promised anything. What we have to go on is the fact that in the past, under the Harper government, all of the liberals who were present in the House at the time that motions came forward saying that the government should cease deportation proceedings against war resistors and that they should be allowed to stay in Canada, all of the liberals who were in the House at the time, which is the vast majority of them, voted in favor of it. So, you know, Minister of Immigration John McCallum voted in favor of that motion. So did Justin Trudeau. That's one thing we have to go on. Now, of course, we have a much increased group of Liberal MPs now in the House of Commons. And there's been quite a turnover, of course, since 2008, 2009, when those motions came forward. However, in the lead up to the election, we sent out a sort of, a letter asking them to support war resistors being allowed to stay in Canada should they form the new government, the next government. And the reply we got from many of the MPs who responded was a sort of a standard reply. And if it's okay, I'll read it out.
Please do.
So your listeners can understand. Their response to our correspondence was, "The Liberal Party of Canada has consistently held the view that the Canadian government should not turn its back on Americans who have refused to participate in wars in which Canada refused to participate and which had not been authorized by the UN Security Council. We believe that Canada should have allowed those people seeking sanctuary in Canada for their opposition to the Iraq war the opportunity to apply for permanent residence status so long as they did not have a criminal record." So it's a slightly, you know, it's not what we've been asking for. I think we've asked for a much more straightforward, that they should be not just allowed to apply for permanent residence status, but that they should be allowed to stay at this point. Nonetheless, it tells you that they disagreed with the treatment, clearly, that the war resistors received under the Harper government. So that's what we have. We also had, there was a Liberal fundraiser in Winnipeg, I believe, in July of last year, so in the lead up to the federal election. And at that time, the spouse of one of the war resistors, Joshua Key's spouse, Alexina, raised the question, asking Justin Trudeau, would a Liberal government proceed in a different way and let war resistors stay? And that the reply that he gave, in essence, I would say, just to be fair to what he said, because I don't have a transcript before me, but essentially was that a new government would look at these cases with a view to compassion and fairness. So that's what we have to go on.
So then, do you have any insights into exactly why that appears not to be the case now, that they're letting this litigation go through? And, is it simply a question of being too busy, or what does your best instincts tell you is happening here?
This is really an important question, because it's conceivable that, of course, it's been 5 months since we've had the election. Our first meetings with MPs were over 4 months ago. It's been incredibly busy on the question of the Syrian refugees. So there's no doubt that the Minister of Immigration has had a lot to work on. But I don't think it's possible that this simply wasn't noticeable to them as an issue. We have had lobby meetings across the country, very pointed discussions about this particular issue, the litigation, stopping the litigation. We have written to the Minister of Justice and reminding her of the mandate letter that the Justin Trudeau sent to her about what the priority for the Ministry of Justice should be. Because, of course, just so people understand, the lawyers who are going to be arguing against war resistors on Tuesday and Wednesday are Department of Justice lawyers. Their client is the Minister of Immigration and also the Minister of Justice. It's a slightly, it's a little complex structure. In the mandate letter that Trudeau sent to the Minister of Justice, he said, one of the priorities should be to review our litigation strategy. This should include early decisions to end appeals or positions that are not consistent with our commitments, the charter, or our values. And we certainly feel, and we've argued, that the litigation that was launched by the former Conservative government is not consistent with Canadian views or the Liberal Party's position. As stated, like I said, in the correspondence they sent to us. So why are they letting it go? All I can think is that they agree with going forward with it, because certainly the Minister of Immigration has the power to say we are not pursuing this litigation, as they did with, for example, the appeal of the court decision on interim federal health. You'll probably remember that Stephen Harper cut funding or cut health care for refugee claimants in Canada, and that went to court, and the court said that you cannot do that. You cannot deny refugees health care. And the Conservative government said, we're going to appeal that decision. We're going to spend resources of the Canadian government to appeal this decision. When the Trudeau government came in, they said, we're not going to appeal this. We're going to drop this appeal. We're going to drop this litigation. So that's what could happen in this case. It has not happened. And so really, it's anyone's guess why that is. And it's a question I hope that Canadians will ask of their elected representatives. We certainly are encouraging people to write to the Minister of Immigration on our website at resistors.ca. You can see a model message that people can send asking them to stop this litigation.
Michelle Robidoux, thank you very much for your time.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
You've been speaking with Michelle Robidoux, a campaigner with the War Resisters Support Campaign based in Toronto, Canada. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Our next guest raised concerns about how the U.S. military-industrial complex may be using the Canadian census as a means of obtaining information about Canadians. I spoke to her recently about her research into the U.S. company Statistics Canada contracted with in preparing the 2016 census. Sandra Finley is a community activist and a former leader of the Green Party of Saskatchewan. She was a longtime resident of that province until she moved to B.C. a couple of years ago. She served on the University of Saskatchewan Senate and has been outspoken through her website and other fora on issues related to war and peace, sustainability, and Canadian sovereignty. 10 years ago, she drew a lot of press attention for refusing to fill out the 2006 long-form census, alluding to the involvement of the defense contractor Lockheed Martin Corporation in that process. Tell us more about her experience and the ongoing concern she has about the census, privacy rights in the country, and Lockheed Martin is Sandra Finley. Sandra, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me, Michael.
Could I first of all just get you to explain in your own words, what was your personal motivation for taking such a stand?
It became known in the activist networks that work had been contracted out to Lockheed Martin Corporation. I recall that the Friends of the Quakers, the Society of Friends in Nova Scotia, had done a lot of research on who Lockheed Martin is and what they do in the world. I had read that and concluded, there's no way that these people should be involved with the database on Canadians at Statistics Canada. At that time, you know, I didn't know. I mean, of course, what's happened is that over the years, the information about them and their operations has expanded. But at that time, even it was known, for example, that they operate outside Canadian and international law. And I simply don't understand why it is that you reward companies that are that operate, as I say, outside our laws. So, for example, they were manufacturers of landmines. They were, and then later, following that, they were manufacturers of the cluster munitions. And those are both illegal under Canadian law. What we have learned since then is that they were the number one, what's called contract interrogator at the American offshore prisons, such as Abu Ghraib and, I mean, Guantanamo. People would be very familiar with what happened at Guantanamo Bay, the torture and other things that, again, are completely outside of the operation of international law. And so they were a number one participant in that. And again, those are people that you just do not reward with large contracts. Their presence in Canada has been to promote the purchase by Canadians of their F-35 stealth bombers. And there's been lots of resistance, thank goodness, to those contracts.
So at that point, it was basically just a question of not wanting to deal with a kind of a company that sort of got blood on its hands, like mining, certain mining companies that assault Indigenous peoples or other companies that have these sorts of unethical practices, that the Canadian government shouldn't be involved with them, just as a partner.
Yes, very much so. And at that time, there was also a lot of concern about the Patriot Act and its effect on access to databases. So, I recall that that in British Columbia there had been an attempt by the government to outsource the administration of health records, and American corporations were in line to provide that service. And so the BC Privacy Commissioner in 2004 did an analysis of the Patriot Act, and that included consultations that were, I think, quite wide. And what was concluded was that the Patriot Act superseded any laws that might exist in Canada. And if an American corporation had access to a database on Canadians, the way that act worked is that the American government, so you'd be talking the Defense Department, I presume, maybe CIA, FBI, NSA, could order that they be given access to the database, and the owner of the database, which in the case of Statistics Canada, it would be like the government of Canada, there was no requirement at all to notify the owner of the database if access was provided. So all you had to have was an American corporation and or a subsidiary, a Canadian subsidiary of that entity in Canada with, working on a database so that they had access to it. And as I say, they would be compelled to hand over the access to the database to the American government. And so that was another bone of contention. And today, of course, that has morphed into the spying that's been done by the NSA, the American NSA, the surveillance that they are doing. And Edward Snowden and Glenn Greenwald have done a wonderful job of, helping to expose the amount of, I guess what you could say is the insecurity of databases, because what happens is that the American interest in surveillance will forge what is referred to as backdoor access to a database if they can't obtain legal front door access. So again, it's a matter of installing the means at the back end of the database there so that the American surveillance system can access the database that way. So that, you know, so now we don't talk the Patriot Act anymore and its implications for the security of personal information on Canadians that's in that database. We talk about it in relationship to the that known surveillance function.
Yeah, you know, the StatsCan has insisted that your information is confidential and that this Lockheed Martin is just supplying the software or the technology that processes it. But I think what you're saying is that, you know, they have, when you talk about backdoor access, it's like a special key that they have that can unlock anything that's consistent with the software, so they can get it if they really wanted to.
Yeah, I don't see how that cannot be a factor. And then there's other, you know, other information that people know right now, and for me personally, another issue is the credibility of the information that we get from Statistics Canada, and it is not always the truth. So you get, first of all, reassurances. Oh, no, this is just fine. You know, no, of course, nobody has access to this database. You know, we'll ensure that they don't. But then simultaneously, it is a fact, and I know this from my trial, and I know it from subsequent information, that what's happened now in the world is that the American... that the Americans under Lockheed Martin have forged relationships amongst different nations for the, you know, so that their census operations are compatible, that the information, the data that they collect on citizens is compatible. So if that would apply in, we know, like, first of all, of course, it's the United States at the leadership. Then there's Canada. We know that for sure. Then there is the United Kingdom and people over there, like in the UK, they mounted resistance to Lockheed Martin's involvement in their database on, you know, for their on citizens. And then you've got Australia and New Zealand are both part of a, you know, that network.
The Five Eyes.
Exactly. I didn't know whether your listeners would be familiar with that acronym or term. Yes, absolutely. And I don't know how far beyond it extends, but, you know, one thing that that I did find on the Statistics Canada website by, you know, that there's four items on it. If you Google, or pardon me, if you search Lockheed Martin on the Statistics Canada website, there are four entries that come up if you do a, you know, the largest search possible. And two of those are travel expense claims that have been submitted to the government to pay. And in the title of those travel expenses is travel to the it's like an international forum on censuses, and with Lockheed Martin, meetings with Lockheed Martin in its role as what's called on the expense claim the steering committee for that, you know, for those operations. So to me, it's pretty clear that there are very, very serious issues for Canadians around Lockheed Martin's involvement at Statistics Canada, no matter whether, you know, if they say that, oh, well, they're no longer involved, well, yes, they are actually still involved because of this, for one thing, the international collaboration between the Five Eye countries at the minimum, and Lockheed Martin is part of that. You know, they're providing the steering committee for it.
Got the Lockheed Martin is essentially, you know, essentially helping form these networks that allow all of this data to be centralized.
I would say yes, and when you have, as I recall looking at a defense strategy for Canada, and right near the top of it, what the you know, the strategy listed in the Canadian document for defense was that they, or we, would have interoperability and compatibility. Compatibility first would come first, and then interoperability. Because what you need is, if you've got compatibility in databases or in, you know, the things that you're undertaking to do, then you've got interoperability. You don't have that interoperability if you don't have, if everything is incompatible. And so what you have is that also, I mean, Lockheed Martin is a contractor to the NSA, which in, I mean, that's the height of the surveillance function in the United States. And they are surveilling not only their own people, but, you know, as is known from those, you know, between WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, and Edward Snowden, you know that is, you know, that, for example, Angela Merkel from Germany was, and France, those companies have been outraged by the fact that the Americans are surveilling them too. And when you say surveilling, it is, you know, actually like intercepting and looking at, having access to, you know, what are government communications. So what you get, and what I think is a problem for Canadians, is that you get a loss of sovereignty. It is as though this, you know, American empire is extending its tentacles, and has. And one of the
Lockheed Martin. I mean, it's not just another nefarious private company, you know, like a Walmart or Monsanto or whatever. I mean, they seem to, it almost seems to be in a class by itself as a special tool for enabling this whole centralizing apparatus. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. It would be very, very difficult to draw a line between where the American, you know, so-called Defense Department, I think it's the War Department, but at any rate, you know, to draw a line that a separation between the American Defense Department, the CIA, the FBI, the NSA, and Lockheed Martin Corporation, you'd be very, very hard-pressed to do that.
What about, I mean, I know you're a University of Saskatchewan senator. I think your term's coming up soon, if it hasn't already. What about how that impacts academia with databases and universities? Is that an issue?
Well, for me, part of what people should know is that, so what you have is, for example, you can see Lockheed Martin kind of worming its way into Canada through through its involvement in something like the database at Statistics Canada. But what they've also done, and this has started up some time ago, is that they started going into the universities too. And they're, you know, for your listeners, if they were to do a search on the Minerva Initiative, what you find is that there is a stated, written down policy in places where there are American interests and this is, you know, maybe just aimed originally at American universities, but what they've stated as a, you know, as a policy is that they need to form relationships with the universities, not for the purpose of, like, so it's not, and specifically they don't talk about engineering departments, for example, which you could perhaps understand, but they're specifically talking about the social sciences, those ways that people have of understanding human behavior or manipulating human behavior or
psychological operations.
Yeah. Yeah, and so at the University of Saskatchewan, for example, they came on campus promoting their what are called collaboration topics. And so then they invite the, you know, members of faculty to submit proposals for funding to them. They then dictate what, you know, what research will get done. And in the collaboration topics, as they were presented at the U of S, they were very, very, to me, terrible initiatives around war, basically, is what they were. But then what you had happening is that when at Senate, we challenged the, you know, the collaborations with Lockheed Martin, and I think this is how they corrupt, they are a corrupting influence. What you had was the at that time acting head of the engineering faculty, who's very a prominent longtime member of faculty at the U of S, saying no, that what they were doing was their interest was in the development of green technologies. And that's what they, you know, that's what it was all about. But that contradicted totally what Lockheed Martin's own proposals for collaboration topics stated. And they are buying their way to with now with First Nations communities. I think what they found was that they, you know, it's maybe more difficult for them in Canada to get the social license to do what they want because we're a smaller country. We're, you know, well connected. We can get information to other citizens perhaps more easily so that people understand what this, you know, what this a company is actually all about. And so to buy that social license, that acceptability, they're now, you know, Brad Wall, the premier of Saskatchewan, I recall, now this is going back, you know, a couple of years at least, but he announced that there was this collaboration between the First Nations people on his side of the province in the Swift Current area, Lockheed Martin, and then they pull in government money as well, and what they were funding was actually green technology. It was some efforts around wind energy.
There's another angle to the concerns you've raised that doesn't seem to penetrate very deeply into the Canadian psyche at present. I mean, it was with the Liberals returning to power and the long-form census returning, it seemed that a lot of, you know, progressive-minded Canadians were overjoyed by that. And, you know, one stickly little point that you raise in your writing is that we have a charter right to privacy, and the long-form census appears to be a breach of that privacy. I mean, people, you can't, you know, force people to give up that, to give up their privacy, but that's essentially what the census does if you're being penalized if you don't comply, right?
Yes, and thank you for bringing that up, Michael. And that was the basis for the defense during the time that I was in and out of court, was that we have a charter right to privacy of information. And it's quite eloquently stated. You know, it's, you know, this personal information is information that people in a free and democratic society would want to have. So you've got your personal information, but you cannot be forced to, you know, to disclose it to the governments. And that wisdom of that charter right arises out of the experience of, for example, the Nazi regime during the time of the Second World War. And ironically, or maybe not ironically, what had happened there was that the American census became mechanized, and eventually IBM bought up that technology, and so it was of assistance in tabulating the results of these manual censuses in the United States. But then IBM took it over to Germany. That was the first company over in Europe that they went to say, here, you want to mechanize your census and we'll help you do it. And so they set up the punch cards that older people might be familiar with, and the Hollerith, what was called the Hollerith machine. And they had you know, at the height of the Nazi influence in Germany alone, they had warehouses of women who were, and people that were census workers who went door to door collecting data, bringing it back to the key punch operators. And what they were able to do is, for example, identify a Jewish person down to what you refer to as an eighth blood. So that was all census data by which that was done. And then they set up these subsidiaries in other European countries, Austria. There's a whole list of them, and they're on my blog. So that when the Nazis were moving into other countries, there was, in many cases, already census data there that they were able to access that allowed them to go out, you know, to go down to the train station or to the town square and put up a list of, okay, these people report to, the train station and they were headed for an extermination. That was what enabled that. So what you have, so as I say, people then and it's true of any police state or militaristic state, a characteristic of them is that they have detailed files on citizens. That's why we have the Charter Right to Privacy of Personal Information to say, no, you have to guard against that. Well, and what you have happening at Statistics Canada is that there is a census long form that, of course, to me, went way above and beyond demanding under threat of law. You know, you're going to get prosecuted and fined and jailed if you don't supply this personal information to us. But in addition to that, and here's what a lot of people don't realize, is you say if you look at, you've got one database at Statistics Canada. The census happens once every 5 years. So once every 5 years, and it used to be a third of the population. Now, I think because of resistance, they're saying, okay, one quarter of households will get the census long form to fill in. But then in addition to that, regularly throughout each and every week and year in between censuses, they conduct surveys. And Statistics Canada tells citizens, they give them the same threat as they do regarding the census. You have to supply this information, and if you don't, you can be prosecuted, fined, sent to jail. But in fact, the Statistics Act says that surveys are voluntary. So Statistics Canada they're not even operating by the rule of law. They are governed by the Statistics Act. The Statistics Act says that surveys are effectively voluntary. But what you've got, I guess the point that I'm trying to make is that it's not just once every 5 years that the personal information is being collected. There's lots of personal information demanded in these surveys, and whether it's the, there's the labor force survey, there's the household spending survey, there's the, the census long form became the National Household Survey. So it's got the same questions as the census long form. But all of that stuff is feeding into one database. Mm. So you're getting into pretty dangerous territory because your name is on your record in that database. And that I know from, during my trial, that was, at one point I was still representing myself, and I did, even though I'm not qualified to do, and I didn't do a great job, but I cross-examined the Statistics Canada fellow who was at my trial, who was the head of the census operations, and was able to delve into some of those questions. And yes, you're, so that was under oath. Mm. Yes, your name is on there, and like I say, those files are accumulating regularly, and that is a great concern in a democracy. And so here you are from the University of Manitoba, but it's one of the big proponents, as you pointed out, like there's these people who are waving the flag saying, yay, we're getting the long form census back. Well, it's, to me, it's like you're saying, yay, we're moving one step further toward, into this, like detailed files on citizens, which are only characteristic of police states. You just don't do that in a democracy.
You've given us quite a lot to think about, Sandra Finley, and I know your website is quite a wealth of information. But basically a network of different people who are combining their knowledge that doesn't seem to quite fit inside the mainstream narrative. So I'm sorry we have to kind of leave it there, but your website again is sandrafinley.ca.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, and thanks so much, Michael. I appreciate the opportunity to discuss it, with you, and hopefully it'll help other Canadians.
Okay, thank you. We've been speaking with Sandra Finley, a community activist, a former leader of the Green Party, and her website, again, is sandrafinley.ca.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.